As there is now nothing new to be learned from the dead languages, all the useful books being already translated, the languages are become useless, and time expended in teaching and learning them is wasted, so far as the study of languages may contribute to the progress and communication of knowledge, for it has nothing to do with the creation of knowledge. It is only in the living languages that new knowledge is to be found. And certain it is that, in general, a youth will learn more in a living language in 1 year than in a dead language in 7, and it is but seldom that the teacher knows much of it himself. The difficulty of learning the dead languages does not arise from any superior abstruseness of the languages themselves, but in their being dead, and the pronunciation entirely lost. It would be the same thing if any other language when it becomes dead. The best Greek linguist that now exists does not understand Greek so well as a Grecian plowman did, or a Grecian milkmaid, and the same for Latin. Compared with the plowman or milkmaid of the Romans, it would therefore be advantageous to the state of learning to abolish the study of the dead languages, and to make learning consist, as it originally did, in scientific knowledge. The apology that is sometimes made for continuing to teach the dead languages is that they are taught at a time when a child is not capable of exerting any other mental faculty than that of memory. But that is altogether erroneous. The human mind has a natural disposition to scientific knowledge and to the things connected with it. The first and foremost amusement of a child, even before it begins to play, is that of imitating the works of man. It builds houses with cards or sticks. It navigates the little ocean of a bowl or water with a paper boat, or dams the steam of the gutter and contrives something which it calls a mill, and it interests itself in the fate of its works with a care that resembles affection. It afterwards goes to school, where its genius is killed by the barren study of a dead language, and the philosopher is lost in the linguist. Thomas Paine, Age of Reason. Welcome to the Ominous Continuity Podcast. My name is Kevin Cole, and my website is unityofthepolis.com. If you'd like to check out more of my research, you can visit my Patreon at patreon.com/UOP Media, or pick up a copy of my UOP Research Brain. If you'd like a personal, indexed, and searchable copy of the 20-plus years of research that comprises today's show. This episode is a long-awaited interview I had with author and researcher Daniel McCarthy of storyofnowhere.com for his History of Critical Thinking series earlier this year, and I can say it's one of my favorite conversations on this subject to date. Thank you to everyone who reached out with thoughts and comments following an unfathomable loss in my family. I'm working my way back, and I can't thank you enough for your support and encouragement. Without further delay, and because this episode is thorough, this is The Ominous Continuity, Episode 10, The American Revolution of the Mind. Thanks for listening.
Everybody, it's the show you've all been waiting for. Episode 5 of the Story of Nowhere podcast, the grand finale of the Brief History of Critical Thinking series. Part 5, Uniting the Polis, with my first ever guest, Kevin Cole. Kevin's extensive work can be found at unityofthepolis.com, where he covers precisely what we're going to be talking about today. He was also an associate and friend of the late, great John Taylor Gatto, and worked alongside Richard Grove to produce the excellent Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, which is absolutely essential viewing. Aside from the UHL, Kevin has worked quite a bit with Richard Grove and the folks over at Tragedy and Hope Productions over the years, as well as with Brett Venat of the School Sucks Project. I'll link to some of his content in the show notes, along with the Ultimate History Lesson. Kevin's great at what he does, so I'm very happy to have him here with me on the Brief History of Critical Thinking Finale Extravaganza. He spent the past 10 or more years researching a fairly esoteric subject, namely, how and why a modified version of the medieval liberal arts education system has been steadily introduced into American schools by some, let's say, shady characters. Why would shady characters care at all about the liberal arts in schools, you ask? Well, to put it simply, because the liberal arts system can actually be used to artificially construct a homogeneous culture, which in turn serves the interests of those who wish to expand and consolidate their power federally, and indeed, globally. Hopefully you'll recall that I began to mention this in Episode 3, in which I discussed the role of the original liberal arts education back in the Middle Ages. And, of course, we saw even more clearly the limits of that sort of education in Episode 4, which was all about the Enlightenment break from the traditional liberal arts system in favor of something more accessible and material. So for today's show, I really just wanted to let Kevin cut loose and present his discoveries and thoughts about the initial Enlightenment break with the liberal arts system, as well as his analysis of the subsequent movement to repackage and reintroduce the old medieval educational model. I'm riding shotgun in this episode. I really just wanted Kevin to be able to tell the story as he sees it at this point, because, frankly, a lot of what you're going to be hearing in today's show is his own original research. The man's been cutting a new path for quite some time, and I figure there's no sense in me getting in the way. I'm very grateful that he was willing to take the time to come on here and give a very thorough presentation on what I guess you might call the neo-liberal arts education system. And I mean, really, how often do you get to hear original historical research? Especially being presented by the person who actually did the original research. This is a great opportunity, so pay attention. In this episode, we will hear 1. What became of the system which defined medieval schooling and set the parameters of medieval critical thought? 2. Why some enlightened philosophers, particularly American ones, believed this system actually inhibited critical thought? And 3. Who desired to revive this old system of universal culture creation and control? This presentation is the big bow atop the Brief History of Critical Thinking series. It's about where we are now, in an age when curricula are set by a modern-day priest class, in an age when so-called education doesn't serve the pursuit of knowledge, but instead serves larger political and economic interests. If that bums you out, good. It probably should. So let's get to work on making something better. That's what this whole podcast is really all about, self-education. So in that spirit, at the very end of this long talk, we get a little bit of biographical information on Kevin, and then Kevin reads through a list of questions I sent him about how he does his research, and I will include this list of questions in the show notes. So in other words, we end by leaving the history of critical thinking and begin what will surely become an ongoing conversation regarding how to think critically. This is kind of a lightning round. The how-to portion is much shorter than the historical portion of the show. First of all, because I had a time constraint. And second, because Kevin and I may or may not have discussed doing a whole show devoted on how to do thorough, independent research in the future. Speaking of future shows, I've already got episode 6 ready to go, and then after that, you'll be hearing Kevin and I together again, this time in a mini-series we recorded for his Ominous Continuity podcast, all about the influence of a somewhat forgotten ancient Greek philosopher, Isocrates, and his unsung influence on the liberal arts education system. So be sure to check that out at unityofthepolis.com, on Kevin's podcast stream at Podomatic under the Ominous Continuity podcast, or in the Story of Nowhere feed coming soon. Also, be sure to check out my new video show with my wife at storyofnowhere.com, where we talk all about the official journal of the Council on Foreign Relations and try to work out some context behind current events. All right, without further ado, I suppose we should probably get right into it. Like I said, it's going to be a long one. I'll just say that I highly recommend you listen to all the previous episodes of this series before listening to this one, so you can get some key background information on some of what we talk about here. Thank you all for listening to this series. I hope you appreciate its behemoth finale. Make sure you check out my stuff at storyofnowhere.com, and remember to look for all of Kevin's great work at unityofthepolis.com. And with that, let us begin A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 5, Uniting the Polis with Kevin Cole. I am joined by Kevin Cole for today's show, the very first ever guest of the Story of Nowhere podcast. Thank you for doing this, Kevin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. So, in the last show of this series, The Brief History of Critical Thinking, I basically started by discussing critical thought as it arose in the Renaissance following the Middle Ages, and then really focused on how a kind of scientific outlook developed in the Enlightenment, specifically regarding this belief, at least the belief that I seem to have found that held all these Enlightenment and even Renaissance thinkers in common, which was that reality is essentially bound together by some kind of, for lack of a better term, force that makes sense, right? So there's a logical coherence to reality, and that logical coherence is discoverable by the mind of man. Of course, that'd be open to women too, although they didn't always acknowledge that. But regardless, human beings, according to Enlightenment philosophers, have this sort of innate connection to the fabric of reality, and we call that innate connection reason or logic or critical thinking. So I was just wondering if we could start off, if you can kind of summarize what you found about Enlightenment thinking, and specifically what Enlightenment thinkers had to say about reason and logic and mankind's relation to this sensible force that binds the world.
Sure. I think what they recognized was that there was an organizational complex that was buttressed by Christianity, whereas like the Godhead of the liberal arts education system or these earlier ratio studio arms or studium generale, which were the curriculums of the medieval universities and of this tradition of learning, were holding up progress. They believed that they were creating a kind of artificial unity based on authoritative education, meaning that it was being dictated through the traditions and the writings and teachings of religious scholars and Christian thinkers. And when this kind of secularization occurred, they sought to dethrone this organizational complex as a way of trying to reorganize society. Enlightenment thinkers did believe that logic was an instrument for sound reasoning, but they didn't believe that it yielded truth. They started to realize that there was a problem with language. And this really comes through John Locke in his essay on human understanding. I highly recommend people revisit this. His calling out of semantic instability in language really led to a re-questioning of all of authoritative education.
So is it incorrect then to say that the Enlightenment thinkers had this belief that some sort of true universal or unifying knowledge was actually knowable? Or are they saying that all information exists kind of within like a relative box almost? Like, is all data contained within a system? Is it impossible to know like an objective fact because it's all related to something else?
Well, there were definitely aspects of that through like Hume and Spinoza and people that were questioning the object status of material presence, whether or not something exists in itself or whether or not names actually denote to things. So this goes through like a nominalist tradition going back to like William of Ockham, but really filtered, like I said, through John Locke and the Essays on Human Understanding, which were then picked up by Rousseau and were very popular throughout the Enlightenment and played a major role in the creation of public education systems as a rejection of the liberal arts education. Rousseau himself said that the liberal arts were like garlands that you fling over chains, that liberal education had been basically the bane, not the solvent for a correct society, because it led to these like insular aristocracies, and its tradition is based in oligarchy, aristocracy, and monarchy, of which Isocrates would favor either or. And that was largely the tradition going forward, especially the way that Augustine and Isidore of Seville and others used these arts. And they didn't really teach the Greek and pagan arts as they were taught even in Greece and Rome. They substituted Christian authors or people that were presenting summaries of Christian dogma and tradition in order for that to be the new analogical reasoning structure. So by the time you're getting to the Enlightenment, you have, and this is what, you know, Adam Weishaupt and the Perfectibilist in Bavaria were trying to accomplish. Adam Weishaupt was strictly against the Jesuit order and the Ratio Studiorum, which is the liberal arts education appropriated by Ignatius Loyola and applied to the monastic military order of the Catholic Church. But Weishaupt himself was the first professor of canon law who was not a Jesuit. They really resented him for it. And I'm not going to go into the details of all of that, but it's just to point out that throughout Europe, the monastic education and medieval educations were largely under this authoritative vision underneath the Roman Catholic Church and then later the Church of England. And so there's this idea of a clerisy that is tied to the liberal arts education going all the way back to Isocrates. The idea that there needs to be a liberal insular elite that knows the real terrain, and that by bringing some people in, you can kind of buttress that and create factions that, you know, this caste system idea. But the Enlightenment thinkers really just started to realize that the only universal language was creation itself. And this plays a role, like the religious secularization of these ideas taking place at the same time as the educational changing of these ideas, with religious thinking in deism, where you're kind of recognizing that we don't know the big answers and we're going to ascribe them to the ethereal plane, and then we're going to use what remains to make the best of what we can, to try to create a taxonomy of what we know of nature. It was a time of decentralization. And when people recognized that education had been held within this authoritative structure for so long, they realized that the whole of language and being itself was tied to arbitrary asphyxiations of language upon the world. It's not to say that we can't look at the forms and substance and consistency of something and find a universal acceptance of what that is or agreement. But much of what educational history had been encased in had been this idea that there was a original name giver that came down to things that established this kind of ladder of existence, a graduated sense of being. And these are highlighted heavily within Neoplatonic philosophy, but they were just as present in Isocrates' time, especially in Cicero. The idea of gradations of being, that you needed to be along some kind of an initiatory path in order to obtain right thinking. And depending on who's ruling you at the time, they get to control that structure. You know, what grammar you get, what dialectic you are allowed to argue upon, and what culturally is accepted as great speech. But in the Essays on Human Understanding, John Locke realizes that the trivium posits itself arbitrarily as expositing a ideology within it, meaning that we can all agree upon a tree being a tree, but you really have to get at the root of the reality that exists around us and our participation in it to realize that a tree is just a name that we've given a name to something, as well as colors. Everything is a social agreement, like a linguistic contract of sorts, in order to be able to be on the same page. But within that, that recognition, that space of recognition of this, is where they chose to find freedom. When you realize that there are all these other languages around the world, lots of other traditions, and that many of the dominant traditions have succeeded by running amok or killing and raging war against others, and constantly saying, we are the best, we are the best, we are the best, this is, we are the pinnacle of all of civilization. And I thought they were really willing to start to question that. Like, for instance, Diderot's encyclopedia, this famous encyclopedia, which, you know, Jefferson owned copies of, it became very popular in the United States and all throughout Europe. One of the specific things that he did was to change the organization of the encyclopedia, which, of course, the root word being Enciklios Paideia, Isocrates' lineage. But he changed it to where it was no longer, this encyclopedia was no longer organized with the grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, and along the quadrivium. And he made it alphabetical. So this was an organizational change that they thought was necessary to realize that this education had been used for specific reasons to buttress religious power. And it was very much an attempt to sort out what they could pick and choose and still use, you know, secularize these ideas. It's not like they're throwing out everything. What they're doing is they're recognizing that reason is an intrinsic capability and an inherent capability of all human beings. It's just that it can be swayed. So you still have to have the ability to combat fallacious thinking. But whereas most of educational history is, if you want to be a smart person, you need to go to college. colleges, medieval colleges in particular, were thought of as this like gentleman factory. This is going to make you into a specific kind of being, a specific kind of knower, that you possess the grace of a leader, the virtue and the contemplation to be able to make correct decisions, mostly in line with the state, because that's who's giving you power and preeminence after college, or especially in systems of meritocratic rule, or what they call logocracies.
Absolutely. To your point, as far as like colleges being these gentleman factories, it has always bothered me ever since I was a kid, really, how people, I get where they're coming from, but people will say things like, oh, so-and-so went to college, or so-and-so got really good grades. He's very smart. Just because you happen to know a lot of information on a subject, like, oh, you're smart. It's like, well, I'm not so sure, because if you can just memorize a bunch of stuff, and this gets into John Taylor Gatto, you know, if you can just memorize lists of facts and then regurgitate them, yeah, maybe that's like a symbol of education or intelligence, but it really doesn't give you any tools necessarily to actually go out into the world to bend materials to suit your purposes, which of course is something that in the Enlightenment, which is concurrent with the scientific revolution and really comes out of the scientific revolution, we see this breakdown of the artificial divide that you're talking about between like these abstract philosophies of grammar and logic and rhetoric, and these being the vehicles to get to divine truth. These were always separated from the so-called servile arts, right? Because an educated person would never dirty his hands. Obviously, I don't want to make it too general, because certainly like monastic orders, they would garden and whatnot, and they would do things. So I don't want to paint this picture like no educated person was ever like a hands-on individual. That's not the case. But there has always been, and you know, we see it now, and we see it in the Middle Ages, and certainly we see it in the symbols of power in the Victorian era, which we'll discuss in a little bit, where the educated, high-class person, the gentleman, does not engage in the servile or mechanical arts. You know, you call somebody, you call a lower-class person to come and fix your car or repair your hot water tank or whatever. That's the purpose, and the way that society is structured is in this sort of body politic, I guess would be a good way of putting it, where there is the head class and there is the hand class. And with some exceptions allowed for, by and large, they really shouldn't intersect, because now we're talking about, you know, you're the high class person doing the duty of the low class person. That's a recipe for your society falling apart. At least that's what the traditional powers that be had held. And in the Enlightenment, we see the people that created the American state really blowing this apart. When you think of somebody like Thomas Paine, who, you know, when he wasn't freeing countries and writing pamphlets about why the king is a terrible person, he was designing the first iron bridge. You know, he was an inventor. He was interested in actually taking the material world, which had always been thought of as lesser than the abstract world. Well, he said, no, let's actually look at the material world and let's create new things out of it that make life easier. Ben Franklin is maybe the best example of this. And I spend a decent portion of the previous episode talking just about Ben Franklin, because he's such an interesting character in all this, where, you know, he came up with all of these scientific inventions, not by sitting and doing nothing and just imagining stuff, which would have been the ultimate symbol of the educated person, that, you know, the quiet contemplative individual who just holds himself away and does nothing but think. Well, no, Ben Franklin was, you know, he invented the little swimming flippers that, you know, that kid, like he came up with that because he loved swimming. He's like, you know, this would be an interesting thing to try. And of course, electricity, the crazy bastard even invented the flexible urinary catheter. I mean, this is a man of vision, but anyway, what these people, it seems to me, were acknowledging was not so much that the trivium or the classical education system was invalid. What they were talking about, again, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, because you've certainly done a lot more research on it than I have, but it seems to me they weren't so much saying that this was an erroneous system that has no merit. They were just combating the idea, which had been the assumption for 1,000 years at that point, that the trivium, quadrivium, liberal arts system
was the only objective education. Like, this is the thing that we do. If you want to become educated, this is the system that you have to buy into. Whereas these people were saying, no, that's just one system that can exist over here. And what's important about that is, first of all, there are alternatives where we can go out and we can look at reality. We can experiment with reality and create new systems. But it also means that that trivium, quadrivium system, it has its own logic in that if you apply it, we can look and it will create certain results. Like, for instance, political results, where if you have the liberal arts system in place in the way that it had been, you're going to wind up with this kind of caste system, a monarchy with the aristocracy and then a servile class. Is that, generally speaking, what their analysis of the trivium and quadrivium was?
Yes, I think to a large extent. Some of it had to do with dethroning the Christian Godhead, obviously, because a lot of these individuals, if you're thinking Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, they realized that the religious orders had had control of education for such a long time, but also that they realized that it was based in this kind of analogical imparting of a specific kind of ethic, creating that model. So Thomas Jefferson was extremely interested in all things science, writing to Priestley and to these other influential scientific inventors. And he sought to basically create a research university along the model of Humboldt. In Humboldt, his model of Bildungsideal, which Bildungsideal is basically a word that is imparting culture. His version of Bildung or self-cultivation was in contrast to Johann Fichte. Johann Fichte's version of creation was some kind of a positivistic application of what is going to be the case. And it was idealistic, whereas Humboldt had sought to create research universities that were based on the scientific method and based on invention and innovation and not viewing these classes lower than them or not as valid, especially when you're encountering a new quote-unquote unpeopled terrain, if we don't have the discussion of the Native Americans at this time. But they're looking at America as this like wide open area that's going to need to be developed and going to need to have mechanical and all different sorts of ways of attacking a problem to create a society. They were trying to begin the world anew. Thomas Jefferson himself created the University of Virginia, which was supposed to be so, quote, liberal that you could come and go as you please, as you felt educated, if you were a man. I don't think they were allowing women at the time. But particularly when we're talking about the trivium, it's important to not get too far away from the historical meanings of what this just actually was. The trivium was the imparting of, lastly, the Latin language. But before that, the ideas that became the trivium were about teaching Greek. So it's about creating a unified polity using language, meaning that if you can get everybody to speak the same language medium, you've already won in your kind of imperial design. And we're going to talk about that later in the Victorian period, because that's how they were looking at it. Whereas some other cultures may be looking at it in a first person kind of, this is what we need to do. If I can't understand you, we can't have this. So it really comes from that. Like, so when the Enlightenment thinkers were thinking about getting rid of the trivium and the quadrivium or reorganizing medieval education, a lot of it stemmed from the futility of continuing to teach Latin and Greek. And you see the arguments made against that today are, of course, that if you know Latin, you know the key to all language. You can understand everything because you get at the root of it. And there may be something to that to some degree. But the idea that you need to create whole nations continually on the Roman and Greek model is ridiculous. And that's what Thomas Paine and others discovered and posited for the United States. I've shared this before, but not on this podcast. This is from the To the Inhabitants of America, After Common Sense, Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine himself says that he read no other author in order to come upon his ideas. His ideas came about in a practical manner based on the actual facts on the ground. He was very specific to say this is not attributable to education or anything like that. But in the To the Inhabitants of America, these few paragraphs from the American Crisis, he says, I cannot help but sometimes be surprised at the complimentary references which I've seen and heard made to the ancient histories and transactions. The wisdom, civil governments, and sense of honor in states of Greece and Rome are frequently held up as objects of excellence and imitation. Mankind have lived to very little purpose if at this period in the world they must go back 2,000 or 3,000 years for lessons and examples. We do a great injustice to ourselves by placing them in a superior line. We have no just authority for it, neither can we tell why we should suppose ourselves inferior. Could the mist of antiquity be cleared away, the men and things be viewed as they really were, it is more probable that they would admire us rather than we them. America has surmounted a greater variety of combination of difficulties than I believe ever fell on the share of any one people in the same space of time, and replenished the world with more useful knowledge and sounder maxims of civil government than were ever produced in any age before. Had it not been for America, there would be no such thing as freedom left throughout the whole universe. England has lost hers, and a long chain of right reasoning from wrong principles, and it is from this country now that she must learn the resolution to redress herself and the wisdom of how to accomplish it. The Grecians and Romans were strongly possessed of the spirit of liberty, but not the principle, for at the time they were determined not to be slaves themselves, they employed their power to enslave the rest of mankind. But this distinguished era is blotted by no one misanthropical vice. In short, if the principle on which the cause is founded, the universal blessings that are arising from it, the difficulties that accompany it, the wisdom which has been debated, the fortitude which has been supported, the strength of power which we had to oppose, and the condition in which we undertook it, be all taken in one view, we may justly style it as the most virtuous and illustrious revolution that ever graced the history of mankind. And he continues, good opinion of ourselves is exceedingly necessary in private life, but absolutely necessary in public life, and the utmost importance in supporting national character. I have no notion of yielding the palm of the United States to any Grecians or Romans that were ever born. We have equaled the bravest in their times of danger and excelled the wisest in constructions of civil government. And he goes on to say in other passages that human language is local and changeable. It is therefore incapable of being used as a means of unchangeable and universal information. The only thing that can be used this way and presented as universal and unchangeable information is rhetoric or technologies that are developed using this conception of rhetoric, these oratorical conceptions of rhetoric tied to the creation of unity, which is using verbose intellectual speak in order to try to bring people into your ideas. Often the liberal arts are attributed to everybody under the sun, but often back to Pythagoras. Now, it would be interesting for people to look back at John Adams and what he had to say about Pythagoras. You can basically read these conversations of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Thomas Paine, and you can get at the core of why they chose to do this. And you can see how it is very much separated from what later comes. They saw throwing off this education system as a way to start anew in order to have both scientific arts, and if you wanted to learn Latin and Greek, those would be available for people, but it wouldn't be that society would be based upon that. John Adams, Ben Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson all beat the British to creating a American English. They wanted to create a new form of English called American English, buttressed by neologisms or new words, which would create new realities. And they also saw Native American cultures and their semantic ideas as very valuable to this new American English. And they realized that the natives were not without themselves inherent reason. They just had their own ideologies or tribal affiliations, which caused a steering of their society. And there were obviously others that were more violent, but like those of the Iroquois and the organizational structures of the Iroquois were very important in appropriating to the structure of government that the United States chose to adopt.
With regards to what Thomas Paine was saying, I mean, first of all, that's an excellent passage. And I think that we do, and I say we as in just people in general, we have this kind of, I think as a result of the mystification of the past and how we just can't know very much about the Greeks and the Romans. I mean, we could know a substantial bit, but there's always going to be just this disconnect where we can't know what was going on in the minds of the average Greek or Roman individual. And so there's this tendency to attribute magnificent wisdom onto these people. And of course, it's easy to do because you can go back to the ancient Greeks and read the writings of Plato and Aristotle. It's like, all right, this is really interesting. And then you find out that a lot of their works are lost. And it's like, well, what kind of secret wisdom might be holed away in the lost writings of Plato or Aristotle or whatever? And so it's easy to fall into that trap of thinking that these people were so great and, oh, look how far we've fallen. What Paine is saying really does ring true, that we as modern individuals, and even back in the 1770s, those individuals have surmounted so many challenges. They've crossed an ocean, and they were building a new kind of polity, which was actually endeavoring to free people. And of course, there was slavery at the time, and women were not respected as equals with men. And of course, these are issues, incidentally, issues that Thomas Paine talked about. Like, he was not blind to this. He did not like slavery, and he didn't think that women should be second-class citizens. At least I've seen him remarking often on these issues. And so obviously he didn't quite get his way in when the American state was formed. There was still slavery and women were still treated as lesser. But as far as he was concerned, that was wrong. It was against his ideological standpoint. It was against what he thought the Americas could be. And what's really interesting about all of this, what his conclusions were, is that it's based on this idea that, as you said earlier, the one universal language is creation itself. So he is not referring to just centuries and centuries of political thought in order to formulate his idea. Oh, this is based on John of Salisbury and Cicero and all this. He's like, no, this is based on looking around at the world, saying, well, we can organize ourselves this way instead. And it all does ring true. His whole linguistic theory about language being local and all and changeable. Well, look around. I don't need a long string of ancient and medieval philosophers to instruct me in a way that gets me to the conclusion that language is changeable and local. Because just, well, look, have you ever traveled and you see people have different dialects, et cetera, et cetera. There are differences in language. And you could say that you can have a preference for your own language. Fine. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the Japanese are having a hell of a time communicating with each other because their language is dumb. It's like, no, they're fine. You know, they've been able to build a civilization based on that language and it works. And the same holds true with any other system. The language is going to work for the people, because if it didn't work, then the language would have to evolve and change. And so it follows logically. And you don't need this long tradition of philosophers to tell you about this. And yet the whole medieval system, the whole liberal arts system, is entirely based on only referring to old information, which begs the question, well, how did that old information enter into the quote unquote great conversation in the first place? At some point, that must have been new. And so it's like, not to shit on the Amish, but it's like being intellectually Amish in that, you know, at some point in the past, new information just stopped coming in. All right, we've got our auctors. That's enough. No new information. Now we just refer back to them. And if there is quote unquote new information coming in, it's not actually novel information being provided by a scholastic philosopher. It's just a rearrangement of the old information. It's just rearranging the furniture. Whereas these Enlightenment guys were saying, no, the planet Earth is absolutely untapped in its potential. We can make new meanings out of things. We can draw new novel creations out of the material world. And those new creations are going to lead to new linguistic formulations. What do you do when you invent a television? You got to call it something. And so with new material creations comes a whole new deluge of linguistic constructions that conform to a new novel logic that's been given birth by material creation and by this logic of actually observing the world and putting materials together in new creations and in new arrangements, rather than putting old words and philosophies together in new creations, because then you're not doing anything. And that's, I know that the Middle Ages do get a bad rap a lot of the time, and people just kind of gloss over the whole thing as a dark age. Obviously, there were very intelligent people and there were degrees of progress, but I really don't think you can deny that as far as material progress that actually led to improvements in standards of living, you got to give it to the Enlightenment. You just do. It didn't just fall out of the sky. It's a result specifically of their view of the world as being something that can be interacted with directly by the individual who's just tinkering away in his little garage laboratory, all the way up to the educated individual. The opportunities of the planet are available to all. And I mean, that really got kicked off with Francis Bacon when he went to college and said, all of this scholastic, Aristotelian syllogism stuff is boring and dumb. I mean, those are basically his words. He didn't like it. And he thought it wasn't doing any good. Instead, we should go out and experiment, try new things, make mistakes, get our hands dirty. And that's exactly what he did. And there's a reason that Thomas Jefferson included Francis Bacon among what he called the Holy Trinity of men, right? So Francis Bacon, John Locke, and Newton. Thomas Jefferson was like, these are the greatest men who ever walked the earth. And he's not wrong, maybe. he certainly had good reasoning for it. So I'll kick it back to you. I'm really curious to hear that passage on Pythagoras. So,
absolutely great points. It's not that there isn't something to be learned in somebody else's history of ideas, but it's the systemization of the ideas that creates a certain kind of polity. And when Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, and these guys realized that, hey, we don't speak the same type of language that they do, because authority itself goes back to the concept of the auctors, and these were the original authors. And without the knowledge of a supreme name giver, of which Plato tries to denote within Timaeus and some of his other writings, that there's this supreme name giver that came down to give all names to things, and therefore everything is a subordinate to some beauty or perfection idea, or to a perfect version of the form, that the things that we denote are actually imitations of their actual existence on some other plane, which Jefferson and Adams both saw as ridiculous. Like, in their writings to each other, they said just as much, that this guy is unintelligible, in the fact that we've placed so much in his stead in our education system, and that people have risen to power and prestige in this profession, is a detriment to the republic. It's a detriment to the country. I think that's a very important point there. And it's through Bacon and his rejection of some of these earlier ideas that leads somebody like Locke to be able to write his essay on human understanding. For anybody who wants to delve into the rejection of the trivium and John Locke, I would highly recommend checking out a book called Locke, Language and Early Modern Philosophy by Hannah Dawson. It's the best book that I've read on this subject. You can also find some great reviews about it and see if there's anything that you'd like to cross-reference with other works. But she really lays out how the trivium had carried with it this idea of ideological certainty, because it had been a systematic, authoritative educational system all the way back through Isocrates. And a book I would reference for people on that is titled The Legacy of Isocrates and a Platonic Alternative: History, Political Philosophy, and the Value of Education by James Muir, who shows how it is Isocrates and not Plato and not Aristotle whose educational system survived throughout time. Now, we can talk about how Neoplatonic elements were injected in this, where even Jefferson and Adams, when they're discussing Plato being in control of education, they're just basing it on the knowledge that they have at the time, not what we've discovered since then, not what is, you know, they're relying on one specific view of it. But it is not only Plato. It's the idea that there's been a historical miscalculation on which education system actually survived. And it's been an authoritative education that the founders of this country and during the French Revolution and other places were trying to throw off. They were trying to throw off this authoritative education that tried to tell you that you have reason only because somebody who's ordained by God allowed you the privilege of learning it, rather than it being something that's intrinsic and inherent to every individual. I want to read a passage from Thomas Paine first, and then I'd like to read the passage by John Adams on Pythagoras, because I think it highlights how this ties into a rhetorical education. But Thomas Paine said, "Let him believe this, and he will live more consistently and morally than by any other system. It is by being taught to contemplate himself as an outlaw, as an outcast, as a beggar, as a mumper, as a one throne, as it were, on a dunghill at the immense distance from his creator, and who might make his approaches by creeping and cringing to intermediate beings, that he conceives either a contemptuous disregard for everything under the name of religion, or becomes indifferent, or turns to what he calls devout. In the latter case, he consumes his life in grief, or the affection of it. His prayers are reproaches, his humility ingratitude. He calls himself a worm, and the fertile earth a dunghill, and all the blessings of life by the thankless name of vanities. He despises the choicest gift of God to man, the gift of reason. And having endeavored to force upon himself the belief of a system against which reason revolts, he ungratefully calls it human reason, as if man could give reason to himself. Yet with all this strange appearance of humility and this contempt for human reason, he ventures into the boldest presumptions. He finds fault with everything. His selfishness is never satisfied. His ingratitude is never at an end. He takes on himself to direct the Almighty what to do, even in the government of the universe. He prays dictatorially. When it is sunshine, he prays for rain. When it is rain, he prays for sunshine. He follows the same idea in everything he prays for. For what is the amount of all his prayers but an attempt to make the Almighty change his mind and act otherwise than he does? It is as if they were to say, "Thou knowest not so well as I." But perhaps some will say, are we to have no word of God, no revelation? Thomas Paine answers, yes. There is a word of God, and there is a revelation. The word of God is the creation we behold, and it is in this word, which no human invention can counterfeit or alter, that God speaketh universally to man. Human language is local and changeable. It is therefore incapable of being used as the means of unchangeable and universal information. The idea that God sent Jesus Christ to publish, as they say, the glad tidings of all nations from one end to the other of the earth is consistent only with the ignorance of those who know nothing of the extent of the world and who believed as the world saviors believed and continue to believe for several centuries, and that in contradiction to the discoveries of philosophers and the experience of navigators, that the earth was flat like a trencher and that man might walk to the end of it. But how was Jesus Christ to make anything known to all nations? He could speak but one language, which was Hebrew, and there are in the world several hundred languages. Scarcely any two nations speak the same language or understand each other. As to the translations, every man who knows anything of any languages knows it's impossible to translate from one language to another, not only without losing a great part of the original, but without frequently making a mistake of the sense. And besides all this, the art of printing was wholly unknown to the time that Christ lived. It is always necessary that the means that are to accomplish any end be equal to the accomplishment of that end, or the end cannot be accomplished. It is that the difference between finite and infinite power and wisdom discovers itself. Man frequently fails in accomplishing his ends from a natural inability of the power to the purpose, and frequently from the want of wisdom to apply power properly. But it is impossible for infinite power and wisdom to fail as man faileth. The means is used as always equal to the end, but human language, more especially as there is not a universal language, is incapable of being used as a universal means of unchangeable and universal information, and is therefore not the means that God useth in manifesting himself universally to man. It is only in creation that all our ideas and conceptions of the Word of God can unite, that creation speaketh a universal language, independently of human speech and human language, multiplied and varied as it may be. It is an ever-existing original, which every man can read. It cannot be forged, it cannot be counterfeited, it cannot be lost, it cannot be altered, it cannot be suppressed. It does not depend upon the will of man whether it shall be published or not. It publishes itself from one end of the earth to the other. It preaches to all nations and to all worlds, and this word of God reveals to man all that is necessary for man to know of God. And so I think that that underlies the dismantling of semantic universality. And that's just from Thomas Paine taking a survey, a critical thought at where this ideology to him came from, in the ideology behind it, which ties in education, because education was controlled by religion and through the Church of England. The educational institutions in the United States were all based on this same trivium and quadrivium, liberal education, medieval polity model. And they saw this as a potential damage, a potential problem, especially Harvard and Yale and Princeton. And Thomas Jefferson himself sought to dismantle this Oxford triumvirate. And he went out and sought out different colleges, William and Mary and his own college, and acknowledged the only few colleges that had kept up this kind of feudalistic version of liberal education, which were Bowdoin, I believe, and Williams College, which Williams College becomes a host later for the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable Project of reintroducing the liberal education into the United States. But I think Thomas Paine's thinking there from the Age of Reason stands on its own, and that's why he's one of the most brilliant individuals I've read. And all one has to do to see this dismantling of the classics as a uniform kind of thinking is to read the works of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams to each other, in which they discuss their thoughts on Plato and their thoughts on this kind of unitary education, which is the unitary ratio studiorum, which they sought to throw off. Now, we could have another conversation about Thomas Jefferson embraced this kind of Anglo-Saxon myth idea of the yeoman farmer that was educated and practical. And there's a whole nother conversation to be had there. But I think that reality was borne out in the level of innovation that came out of this country, scientific innovation. It does not require these earlier analogical reasoning models. Now you can pick and choose and find philosophical hope and knowledge within all of that. But it's this idea of a systematized ubiquity. Liberal education throughout history was sought to create a kind of Christian or pagan clerisy, those that would be able to think and act for others and be able to express that to people. Whereas Thomas Paine, he said that the American constitutions were to liberty what a grammar is to language. They define its parts of speech and practically construct them into syntax. So the idea was that through a dislocation of unity, through a decentralization of the problems that earlier aristocracies and republics had faced, which was they were pushing a positivistic, must adopt this kind of ideology. This is what it means to be a free citizen. You having these beliefs, etc. They took care of that because they got to the root. They said, okay, well, freedom of speech would allow us to all be able to exposit what we want to say in a free manner. Freedom of religion allows us to our own conceptions of why we're here and what we're, you know, that automatically takes out the earlier functions of education that were based in the Christian monastic system, the adopted liberal arts under the medieval education system, which was very feudalistic. And so there was an attempt later on to reintroduce these into this country. And I hope we can talk about maybe why that is and how it's incompatible with the kind of polity that was originally constituted here. This passage by John Adams is from A Defense of the Constitutions of the United States, Letter 49, and it's called Ancient Aristocratical Republics, Crotana and Pythagoras. I'm not going to read everything here, but I do recommend people go check this out. More intelligent than anything I've read in lately. Like it's very interesting because he points out for people that have heard our episode on Isocrates coming up, you'll get the gist of it and how this liberal education was resisted and why. My dear sir, John Adams says, Pythagoras, as well as Socrates, Plato, and Xenophon, were persuaded that the happiness of a nation depended chiefly on their form of government, that they were fully sensible of the real misery, as well as the dangerous tendency, both of democratic licentiousness and monarchical tyranny. They preferred a well-tempered aristocracy to all other governments. Pythagoras and Socrates, having no idea of three independent branches of legislature, both thought that the laws could neither prevent the arbitrary oppressions of magistrates nor turbulent insolence of the people until mankind were habituated by education and discipline to regard the great duties of life and to consider a reverence of themselves in the esteem of their fellow citizens as the principal source of their enjoyment. In small communities, especially where slaves were many and the citizens few, this might be plausible, but the education of a great nation can never accomplish so great an end. Millions must be brought up whom no principles, no sentiments derived from education can restrain from trampling on the laws, orders of men, watching and balancing each other, are the only security. Power must be opposed to power, and interest to interest. Pythagoras found this by experience at Crotana, where the inferior ranks, elated with the destruction of Sybaris and instigated by an artful, ambitious leader, Cylon, clamored for an equal partition of the conquered territory. This was denied them as inconsistent with aristocratical government. A conspiracy ensued against the magistrates, who were surprised in the Senate House, many put to death, and the rest driven from their country. Pythagoras was one of the banished and died soon afterwards, in extremely old age, at Metapontum. The Crotonans had soon cause to repent in their insurrection, for they were defeated and their forces by the Lucretians and the regions with small numbers. The other Greek cities of Italy, which had imitated the example of Crotana in deposing the magistrates, were harnessed with wars against each other and against their neighbors. In consequence of these distresses, the disciples of Pythagoras again recovered their reputation and influence, and about 60 years afterwards, Zaleucus and Charondas, one of the Locris and the other of Thurium, revived the Pythagorean institutions. In 40 years more, a new revolution drove the Pythagoreans entirely from Italy and completed the misery of that beautiful country. The experience has ever shown that education, as well as religion, aristocracy, as well as democracy and monarchy, are singly, totally inadequate to the business of restraining the passions of men or preserving a steady government and protecting the lives, liberties, and properties of the people. Nothing has ever affected it but these three different orders of men, bound by their interest to watch over each other and stand the guardians of the laws, religion, superstition, oaths, education. Laws all give way before passions, interest, and power, which can be resisted only by passions, interest, and power. It is no wonder that Mr. Turgeot should have entertained very crude conceptions of a republican legislation. It is the science least understood of any whole circle. All other orders of men of letters in Europe, as well as physicians for a long time, have thought it the literae nihil sanantes, which is the literature which heals nothing. This is him describing the tradition of the liberal education and literae humanores. He says, it is the kind of erudition which neither procures places, pensions, embassies, chairs in academies, nor fame, nor practice in the pulpit, at the bar, nor in medicine. A minister of state of great abilities and merit as well as reputation, advanced to the head of affairs of a respectable monarchy by one of the greatest princes that have ever lived, and he means Baron de Hertzberg. He was within a few years of this example at the Royal Academy of the Sciences in the inquiry into the subject. I'm not going to go on, but he's talking about how this system of education that was based on oratory and beautiful thought and education or an erudition which yields nobody, this was in the legacy of Pythagoras. A lot of people within the Freemasonic tradition, they like to say that liberal arts go back to Pythagoras, education, this whole meaning. And what he does there is he just totally throws it away. He goes on to discuss Locke and Hoadley and Spinoza. Men of letters are not fond of martyrdom in this age, nor of the ruining of their reputations. It is not, however, my design to discuss any questions at present concerning absolute monarchies, though the principles I contend for might be traced to the history of every monarchy and empire in Europe. Even in these orders, checks and balances contrived, at least against the abuses in administration, and for the preservation of the laws. The science of government has received very little improvement since the Greeks and Romans. The necessity of a strong and independent executive and a single person in the three branches in the legislature instead of two, and of equality among the three, and improvements made by the English, which were unknown, at least never reduced to practice by the ancients. Machiavel was one of the first who revived the ancient politics. The best parts of his writings he translated almost literally from Plato and Aristotle without acknowledging the obligation. The worst of the sentiments, even in his prints, he translated from Aristotle without throwing him on a reproach. Montesquieu borrowed from this best part of the book of Machiavelli without acknowledging the quotation. Milton, Harrington, Sidney, and others intimately acquainted with the ancients and with Machiavel. They were followed by Locke, Hoadley, and the reputation which was to be acquired by this kind of learning may be judged by the language of Mr. Hume. This is from Hume's History of England. Compositions the most despicable, both of the style and matter, such as Rapin, Thorius, Locke, Sidney, Hoadley, have ever been extolled, propagated, and read, as if they had equaled the most celebrated remains of antiquity. Such is the style in which this great writer speaks of the writings he probably had never read. That's what he says about Hume. This is Hume lamenting the loss of this, you know. And he said there's other times in which Thomas Jefferson and John Adams are looking at each other and writing and saying, what is up with this dude? Like, what is wrong with this guy? And they were not fond of him.
I want to read one more passage here from the Defense of the Constitutions by John Adams, where he's talking about the situation in most countries over time in the historical aristocracies after discussing Pythagoras and his reliance on education and the aristocratical elite model. He says, the people in all nations are naturally divided into two sorts, the gentlemen and the simplemen, a word which is here chosen to signify the common people. By gentlemen are not meant the rich or the poor, the high-born or the low-born, the industrious or the idle, but all those that have received a liberal education, an ordinary degree of erudition in liberal arts and sciences, whether they be by birth descended from magistrates and officers of government, or from husbandmen, merchants, mechanics, or laborers, or whether they be rich or poor. We must nevertheless remember that generally those who are rich and descended from families in public life will have the best education in the arts and sciences, and therefore the gentleman will ordinarily, notwithstanding some exceptions to the rule, be the richer and born of more noted families. By the common people we mean laborers, husbandmen, mechanics, and merchants in general, who pursue their occupations and industry without any knowledge in liberal arts or sciences, in anything other than their own trades or pursuits. Though there may be exceptions to this rule, and individuals may be found in each of these classes who may really be gentlemen. Now it seems to be clear that the gentlemen in every country are, and ever must be, few in number in comparison of the simple men. If you please, then, by the democratical portion of society, we will then understand the common people, as before explained. By the aristocratical part of the community, we will understand the gentlemen. The distinctions which have been introduced among the gentlemen into nobility greater or lesser are perfectly immaterial to our present purpose. Knights, barons, earls, viscounts, marquises, dukes, and even princes and kings are still but gentlemen, and the word noble signifies no more noble or conspicuous. But the gentlemen are intelligent and skillful, as well as generally richer and better connected, and therefore have more influence and power than an equal number of common people. There is a constant energy and effort in the minds of the former to increase the advantages they possess over the latter, to augment their wealth and influence at their expense. This effort produces resentments and jealousies, contempt, hatred, and fear between the one sort and the other. Individuals among the common people endeavor to make friends, patrons, and protectors among the gentlemen. This produces parties, divisions, tumults, and war. But as the former have most address and capacity, they gain more and more continually, until they become exorbitantly rich, and others miserably poor. In this progress, the common people are continually looking up for a protector among the gentlemen, and he is among those who are able and willing to protect them, acquires their confidence. They unite together by their feelings, more in their reflections, and augmenting his power, because the more power he has and the less the gentlemen have, the safer they are. This is a short sketch of history of that progress in passions and feelings which have produced every simple monarchy in the world. And if nature and if feelings have their course without reflection, they will produce a simple monarchy forever. It has been the common people, then, and not the gentlemen, who have established simple monarchies all over the world. The common people against the gentlemen established a simple monarchy in Caesar at Rome, in the Medici at Florence, and are now in danger of doing the same in Holland. And if the British Constitution should have its euthanasia in simple monarchy, according to the prophecy of Mr. Hume, it will be affected by the common people, to avoid the increasing oppressions of the gentlemen. If this is the progress and course of things, and who does not know it is, it follows that is the true interest and best policy of the common people to take away from the body of gentlemen all share in the distribution of offices and management of executive power. Why? Because if the body of gentlemen have the gift of offices, they will dispose them among their family, friends, and connections, and they will make their use of votes in disposing of offices to procure themselves votes in popular elections to the Senate or other council, or to procure themselves appointments in the executive department. It is the true policy of the common people to place the whole executive power in one man, to make him a distinct order in the state, from which arises an inevitable jealousy between him and the gentleman. This forces him to become a father and protector of the common people, and to endeavor always to humble every proud aspiring senator or other officer in the state who is in danger of acquiring an influence too great for the law or the spirit of the Constitution. This influences him to look for merit amongst the common people, and to promote among him those that are such capable of public employments, so that the road of preferment is open to common people more generally, equitably in such a government than an aristocracy, or one in which the gentlemen have any share in appointments to office. I think it really, really ties in, and it gives the foundation for why I'm more concerned myself. There are probably other people you can talk to as far as the Enlightenment goes in Europe, but I'm most concerned with how it relates to America's rejection of the liberal education as the organizing principle for society.
Right. Well, that this is really why I wanted to be sure to have this conversation with you, because that's really the lens that I want to view the Enlightenment through. Because when you're in school, and I would include even university, maybe unless you're like really digging into some historical degree and you're specializing on the American Revolution or whatever, you never really hear the philosophical debate as it was presented by these guys in their letters back and forth to each other. Because, you know, they too much taxation and they got pissed off. And so they said, no more king. And that was that. And, you know, the revolution is looked at as a war, which sure, it was a war and there was fighting, but it wasn't just a bunch of people shooting at each other so that they can like replace one polity with another. And that's that. Like in the Middle Ages, it was, you know, king versus king, and then the one king would die, and so then the other one could sit on the throne. Whereas in the American Revolution, they were actually trying to remove a very, very entrenched philosophical foundation of a society and replace it almost with nothing. They wanted to replace it with something that was more perhaps natural, right? Like when we're exchanging the Platonic or Christian perception of the world as coming through the lens of language, particularly the Latin language, and then later on English, you know, this being the true language, which is speaking the divine truth. And this goes back in the book of Genesis. This is where this kind of justification for the supremacy of a certain language can come from in the Christian worldview, because when Adam is still perfect before the fall, what does he do? What's his job in Eden? It's giving the names to all of the things, right? So, I mean, this is the lineage of the perfect man. Our all father is Adam. And before he fell, he gave things their names. And so what that means, therefore, is there are perfect names given by a perfect creation. And if we could discover these names, now this kind of gets into the Platonic realm of things, if we could discover these true names, then we're going to be coming closer to the actual form of the thing. And, you know, that's a whole philosophical conversation that we can get into. But in the Enlightenment, these guys were, as you pointed out, they were saying, no, the thing is what it is. And we can just describe names and labels to it for practicality's sake. But we are going to be making a big mistake if we conflate the thing with the label. And you know, I think probably no one said it better than Lao Tzu. I mean, the Tao which can be spoken of is not the Tao, right? I love that because it's pithy and perfect, because it's something I wish more people would really take the time to appreciate, this sentiment that the map is not the territory. The word is not the thing. I think a lot of problems, political and otherwise, might be avoided if we would just start thinking and appreciating that fact. But anyway, back to what I was saying, I want people to really appreciate how important these kind of curricular debates and discussions were going back to the American Revolution, when, again, we see it as a war, and war is really easy for us to categorize in our minds because, you know, violence and then a new leader arises and that's how it goes. But this isn't just like a bunch of highfalutin intellectual stuff that we're talking about that doesn't matter, right? Like, this is arguably more important than the shooting war that took place back in 1776. Like, this is the revolution. We're talking about people changing, drastically altering their assumptions about how a society should be structured. And they're not just rearranging society willy-nilly. They're going down to the root. Like, these are the axioms that society has stood on for 1,000 years or more. And we're going to hit those axioms. We're not just going to rearrange the furniture. We are going to bomb the building, for lack of a better term, you know. So this is really crucial, I think, to people appreciating and understanding what the American experiment was. And how it relates, you know, this whole series is about the history of critical thought. And the American Revolution is absolutely crucial in the story of critical thought, because the whole revolution, the thing that we're talking about right now, the whole basis of American independence was literally about questioning how critical thinking is done. Like, the whole thing is built on a logical theory, and combating the old logical theory and replacing it with a new open source logical theory, which says, go out in the world, try shit, fail, 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 and then succeed, whatever. Everyone has their own route to take. Everyone's got their own journey. And the sooner we start opening up people to possibility, of course, that will mean there will be more failures. This is how experiments work. But it also means there will be more progress, and it means there will be more successes. The more we try, the more we experiment, the better the world can be. And now, of course, we can get into from here the discussion on, well, maybe just untrammeled progress is a bad thing. You know, that's an argument that is worth having. We don't need to have it here, but it is important to consider that, you know, what are all these inventions leading up to? Maybe they're making life more complicated. Maybe they're damaging the environment or our relationships, blah, blah, blah. These are all valid things. And I don't just want to brush that aside. We can get to that perhaps in another show. But the point is that regardless of what kind of value judgments we want to make retrospectively on the progress that the Enlightenment kicked off, we cannot deny the simple facts that by altering the assumptions that people held about what an education is and about what intelligence is and what humanity's mental relationship to the world is, this created a revolution, not just in how people arrange themselves, but literally in how lives are lived. I mean, medicine, transportation, vehicles, everything come, all of the material successes that have made our lives what they are, that have ultimately led to the technology we're using right now to communicate. I mean, virtually in a time machine, because when people listen to this, we won't be recording it anymore. We'll have done it, you know, so we could preserve our voices. And the proliferation of books and pamphlets was obviously a humongous basis for how the Enlightenment ideals were spread. You know, I mean, if it weren't for the printing press, you wouldn't have the Republic of Letters, as they called it, that the Enlightenment essentially came out of. So all that is to say, I want people to appreciate that, you know, we're not just talking about the history of the United States for fun. Like, this is actually crucial and very important to the story of critical thinking as I'm trying to introduce it to people through the series. America was built on a theory of critical thinking. I mean, I don't even think that's too much of a generalization. Based on the evidence that you're providing and based on what I've read, I really don't think that that's too much of a leap to say. The revolution was in logic. It was about how we look at the world and where reason comes from and how it's applied to the world.
And by using our innate senses of reason in order to recognize a problem and then try to find the most common ground solution for that, which was in their sense to have the Bill of Rights, to take out these ideological hammers that cause war, that cause factionalization, and to allow these to all exist. I mean, even John Adams got letters from people that were in the Perfectibilist and in these secret societies, and they said, hey, could we come over to Indiana? We hear you guys are cool with that. Like, you know, could we set up a little conclave? And he didn't really, you know, acknowledge who they were at the time, but he was just kind of like, we are under no pretense to deny anybody of anything based on their religious proclivities. And of course, Thomas Jefferson theorized that all people possessed an innate moral sense, a faculty of reason that we share. So from these basic examples of what it would take to find common ground, they went out from there. Jefferson and these guys could speak Greek and Latin and read in it, some better than others. But they didn't feel that this was necessarily how they wanted to perpetuate American unity. Can you imagine you're going to set up a new country and then you're going to educate people in this like arcane set of languages that you learned? This is from Paradoxes of Education in a Republic by Eva Braun. She says, all of the founders, among whom Paine the exception need not be numbered, had classical training, some especially Adams, Jefferson, and Madison, a very thorough one. They had the taste and the tools appropriate to the classical education. They were founders of a polity without a, quote, model on the face of the globe, from Madison, who had the advantage of a perfect self-awareness because they knew that which allowed to distinguish them from the new from the old. Just one example, they knew in detail and from the original sources what it was that made the antique participatory democracies unsuitable models for modern republics. But they were in the condition of all successful liberating generations. They made that obsolete which made them what they were. The problem is that, as she thinks, as the process of obsolescence progressed, their own founding would be obscured. From when the ancients become inaccessible, the moderns become unintelligible. And from Thomas Jefferson's creation of the University of Virginia, his plan for a great foundation expressed that this was to be founded upon a plan so broad and liberal and modern as to be worth patronizing with public support. He wrote that to Joseph Priestley, the discoverer of oxygen, on January 18th of 1800. The deeply radical general character of this plan was that it was no unitary ratio studiorum, but a completely eclectic composition of various materials, which are, quote, good for us. So that's how he set up his
University of Virginia, which just happens to be the place in which the Rhodes Scholar Project to reintroduce liberal education into the United States takes place later. This is where they sought to go, because Jefferson was viewed as illogical and insensible for not agreeing that you had to have a specific kind of education in order to participate and perpetuate a certain kind of polity. This is a book called Great Books, Honors Programs, and Hidden Origins, The Virginia Plan and the University of Virginia in the Liberal Arts Movement. And he says, hidden origins. This doesn't look like a book that's really nefarious or conspiratorial. It talks about the beginnings of the Great Books of the Western World Project, which was part of the goals and purposes of the transnational elite at the time. There was an attempt to reestablish classical education as the baseline for education in the United States, both as a kind of clerisy or aristocratic class, or what they would call the New Mandarins, this idea that you need a kind of logocracy that interacts with the world at a higher level, and then you have people at a servile level below that. But this is something that was already thrown off at the American Revolution. They didn't believe that learning Greek and Latin would make you anything more special. Maybe Adams did at times. Jefferson rejected it, although he allowed Latin and Greek and whatever other language could be taught at a school, French, to be taught. But it wasn't the dominant way in which you would learn anything. Ben Franklin, in his own autobiography, talks about how it wasn't necessary. And for his attempts at creating a institution of American English, which he did in Pennsylvania, and for John Adams' attempts at creating an American institution of English, which I believe he did in Massachusetts, and then Noah Webster, in particular, Noah Webster is the guy you want to look for in this. There's a great book called The Dictionary Wars. At the time of the American Revolution, the dominant dictionary in the United States was by Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson's dictionary. It was just read the other day in some congressional hearing when they were referring back to the definition of something. It's like, here's Johnson's dictionary. And I thought that was funny because Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Noah Webster all thought that Johnson's dictionary was a big problem for the establishment of a new polity in the United States, for imparting the ideas of civic education. Because what all of these people believed was that inherent in language itself were the authoritative mechanisms that lead to tyranny. And Thomas Paine, I think, is one of the first people to present this kind of radical linguistic thinking. He believed that you needed to go back to the root of every word, you know, and you could find your meaning by dissecting that, not how it had been changed over time or reappropriated, but it's this idea of semantic universality and semantic instability that very much paralleled the revolution itself. Because what is proper spelling? Well, that's arbitrary authority that's based on nothing. Somebody tells you, oh, you spelled your wrong, you're dumb, you're a barbarian, you don't think right. But in reality, if you can understand me and we can come to an understanding that, no, I'm not stupid. I just like saying it this way. And if you look in the dictionary, some countries say it this way and some people say it this way. And we can come to terms without vilifying the other person, you know, and that's what happens. That's what happens all throughout schooling. That's why schooling is schooling, because it's all about keeping you in that pool of fish. And even your friends and family will do this to you. You mispronounce a word and you get that feeling of shame. You know, like, oh, man, even if you know better, it's like, I mistook, but now that person thinks I'm dumb because I didn't say oligarchy right that one time or whatever word is. And that's the reality of it. That's what creates this, you know, it's this as a microcosm to, you know, nation states, really, if you want to, you know, make it simple. But when somebody tries to claim arbitrary authority over you using your language, now, sure, we can agree. We can have a conversation like, hey, man, like, you know, in these instances, if you're trying to appear intellectual to the people around you, you may want to spell that properly, because otherwise they're going to get fixated on that one thing and think your other ideas are wrong because you don't meet their idea of what something is. But in the reality of it, without a supreme name giver that came down to give names to things, Daniel and I could, you know, start calling a tree an umlaut and like have a, you know, a secret code together, and we could create our own little society in which trees are umlauts now, and that's just what it means to us, and we could create a whole nother reality.
But the way to have an empire, how to overthrow this knowledge, because this is the knowledge that perpetuates freedom. It's the basis of all authority. Because if you can't recognize the intrinsic value of another to be able to speak however they want to speak, you want to exercise your authority over them when it's just arbitrary. And it's only not arbitrary if your beliefs are so full that you believe that that is the one true reality, in which you are a dominator, a colonizer of my culture. You're colonizing my way of wanting to say something. What if I've consciously decided that I don't like saying this specific word that way, and you're going to stop me in the middle of something and try to correct me and tell me I'm wrong? Where'd you get the authority, you know? And so the supreme irony or hypocrisy would be like an anarchist who corrects your speech. You know what I'm saying? Like somebody, like, because you're not standing under any authority, but yet you're telling somebody else that they have said something wrong or that they've said something incorrectly. Now, there are many of great instances in which somebody tells you to grab the ladder and you're not holding the ladder and you're like, I don't understand that word. I can't help you, you know, whatever. We come to an agreement. We don't exist in an atomistic fantasy that I think a lot of movements kind of buy into as their FU to any kind of authoritative control, because it's really about a linguistic, nominalistic rejection of authority that real freedom exists. And this is what I get from Locke and from Locke's essay on human understanding, and then from Thomas Paine. Freedom exists as a linguistic, nominalistic strategy. Just because somebody speaks a different language than you doesn't make them any less intrinsically valuable to you. They have their own thoughts and thinking. Now, it's when one culture comes into conflict with another and one is doing something that is viewed as abhorrent to the rest of the world, where you get this colonization kind of effect where somebody wants to say, like, what you're doing is so bad that I have to intervene. You guys are, you know, eating people or whatever. But that's what it really comes down to. And it's what a lot of people have trouble with, because they want to believe that there is this like universal moral sphere in which, you know, we can all tap into. And that's what it is. Plato theories of forms or forms of perfection or Jacob's ladder of climbing some hierarchy, you know, and depending on what ideology you were raised in or lack of ideology you were raised in, you'll find a different kind of value in this this information, because somebody right now who heard that Thomas Paine quote is thinking these irreligious, sacrilegious people, these, you know, antichrist, you know, somebody rather, because he's saying that the word of God is creation and that that's the only language that we can, you know, seek to understand and we're a part of it and that kind of a thing, which is really what the church has obscured for all of history, leaving out certain parts of the Bible and leaving in certain parts of the Bible or changing certain parts to make it more in line with the authoritative rule of the time, or, you know, give unto Caesar and all these different ideas. I hope that gets to the nature of your overall question there as far as enlightenment thinking. The most important thing to take away from it is really for people to think about where their conception of true knowledge comes from and what correct thinking is versus what correct thinking is over time. How do you critically evaluate ideologies? How did you come about a certain kind of viewpoint? Were you raised within it where that's the only thing you know? The realization of the unstable nature of language and the ways in which authority was thrown off was through a kind of linguistic, nominalistic rejection of authority, saying, I know, I understand what you're saying, but we're choosing not to hear you anymore. Putting your fingers in your ear and saying, I'm going to go live free on my own. I'm going to do my thing. I have the freedom to do so. I have an innate reason. I have an innate moral sense. I have a biological need that needs to be met. And I need to take that out into the world and find a practical use of it. And people would pick and choose from any authors or any historical figures that they felt were relevant at the time. Thomas Jefferson largely rejected Plato in favor of Epicurus, Epicurean philosophy, and the philosophies of Pierre Gassendi, and really the scientific basis of Greek and Roman thought going back to the Ionians. They felt very much that the Greeks and Romans were enslaving people. And later on, with the research that we'll talk about in another show with Basil Bernstein and the sociological look at the trivium and quadrivium, you will see how this creates a kind of divide between the inner and outer world by having this ethics and physics what it became, the trivium and quadrivium, these stratifications of knowledge and the claims that go along with it, that this was some kind of universal truth, some universal truth behind it. When you really look at Isocratian education and the history of the liberal arts, the artes liberales, the ratio studiorum, the studium generale, these curriculums that came to dominate educational authority from Roman times through the Middle Ages, through the Neoplatonic reconceptions of these ideas.
I think hopefully at this point, the audience is clear on not just, you know, why we're talking about this, the fact that the American Revolution, and perhaps that might be the pinnacle of Enlightenment philosophy, this the creation of the American nation, and, you know, arguable degrees of success. That's another conversation we could have, of course. But yes, the creation of this new American polity is, in fact, based on the Enlightenment ideas about critical thinking, about the plentitude of reality being available to all people, and this acknowledgement of, while the individual can interact subjectively with the world, the Enlightenment thinkers are fundamentally acknowledging within their worldview that there is an objective reality. But the difference that they had with their conception of the objective reality versus the older medieval conception of objective reality is theirs was actually rooted in material things and in the thing in itself, as opposed to the linguistic Platonic conception of objective reality as something that is this divine ethereal form. And the material world is actually an imperfect shadow of that. The Enlightenment thinkers were kind of flipping that around and saying, no, actually, it's the material world that's real, and our conceptions become the shadows. Our conceptions are the things which are labels instead of the other way around, which had been the normal assumption for such a long time. And of course, their epistemology of material things being real and our conceptions being subject to change becomes actually the basis of science itself. And the scientific method and epistemology they were applying is actually, in fact, testable. So we can build an airplane and it can not work. And then we know that, you know, that gives us information about the world. And then we can reformulate our approach and then finally make something that does, in fact, work. Whereas the only testability that the scholastic method had, the only testability was, well, does my syllogism hold up? Are my premises true? But it's all based on these axioms of, you know, we're assuming that what Cicero had to say is accurate. We're assuming that the Bible is accurate. And then if we base our assumptions on those quote unquote facts, then we can just create these logical systems that are internally coherent, but might in fact be based on nothing. So the Enlightenment project was to throw that off. And I ended the last episode by talking about some Catholic, I guess you would just call them decrees. There were papal bulls. A few of them were papal bulls and others were just letters that popes were writing in the late 1800s all the way up until 1910, rejecting the heresy of Americanism because it had within it this idea that, look, we can accept all different worldviews. You can come to America and you can have your little Catholic thing, and that's fine. But you're also going to have the Quakers over here and you're going to have the atheists over here. We exist in this plurality of cultures in the United States, whereas, of course, the Catholic, which is universal, that's the Greek word for universal, is Catholic. It's intrinsically imperialistic in a way, in that, you know, it's our project. We have to save the world. Whereas the American thing was, you can go and be saved by Jesus over there, and we'll be when we'll build the airplanes over here, you know. So all that being said, I want now to move to the next stage in the story of critical thinking. And we probably won't spend as much time on this episode of critical thinking as we just did on the Enlightenment. I mean, obviously, the Enlightenment conversation is something that there's plenty more that we could say about it. And I'm sure we will in the future. We could do a million more episodes on just that subject. But the reintroduction of the trivium, quadrivium, liberal arts system into America, specifically as a tool of the whole what Carol Quigley revealed as the Anglo-American establishment in creating this global polity that was effectively run by not the American people and not the British people, but by a small cabal of elite individuals and elite families and elite banking dynasties, what have you, effectively subordinating the globe to the wishes of these people. I mean, you've been involved in this larger conversation about the Anglo-American establishment for probably more than 10 years, right? I mean, Richard Grove is another one that people should listen to, and Brett Vanat. I mean, you've all been having this conversation. It's not beginning here on this show, and it's not ending here on this show. It's something that's just going to keep going and going and should keep going. And so that being the case, I don't even want to try to be definitive here. Like, this can just be an introduction to this topic because it is so big and it's so weird. And it's not something that people know about the reintroduction of the trip. Like, what? That doesn't even, what is that? You know, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. And it might sound, as what we were talking about with the Enlightenment, it might sound like almost irrelevant academic, just like, oh, who cares? It's just, you're just talking about curricula here. How important can that really be? It turns out it's all very important. How a polity is educated is going to affect how it organizes itself and who it supports as leaders, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to try and squeeze all of that stuff into this show. So let's just go over a basic introduction. Like, how would you introduce this very complicated subject of the reintroduction of the liberal arts into the United States to somebody who has no idea what any of this stuff is? Like, how would you softly introduce these subjects to a newcomer?
Well, I would say that the system of education that was intended for the United States was one that was mainly just based on civic educational ideas, basic understanding of the necessity and history of the American Revolution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, the reasoning, logic, and history of why these events took place. That is something that is really the only thing necessary to re-perpetuate to a populace in America, if you have a system that is not based on creating a certain type of being or in a certain type of individual. Now, before the American Revolution, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton in that order all had the education system that came from Oxford University. Oxford University and Bologna being two of the last kind of vestiges of this elite literae humanores classical education system technology. I'm going to call it a technology because that's what it really is. It's a techne. It's an artistic techne that you can use for certain purposes, like an operating system. Now, when you're dealing with human beings who have free will, it's very difficult to just say, read all of this, and then you're going to think the way I want you to think. That wasn't the goal. The goal was to create a certain kind of grace, a certain kind of individual with a certain kind of grace, a certain kind of proclivity to a accepted kind of thinking, one that could participate in the larger political conversation of the polis or the polity at the time. In the United States, the trivium does not provide the actual ends of education. It actually has no use in the same way that would have been used in these earlier polities, because they have dismantled the necessity for this type of government. The liberal education idea I can show through many periods of time, including up to the reintroduction of the trivium by those in the Victorian period. It was tied to this idea of a commonwealth or the greater chain of being, the acceptance of all human beings within a hierarchy leading to a point of higher learning or higher being or in touch with the whole of the universe. They're very abstract ideas that are, you have to be able to sort through what comes actually from Plato, what comes from Neoplatonic authors as well. But in trying to break this down in the most general way for people,
in the United States, they didn't at first attempt to set up a universal education that would be mandatory for everybody that you had to learn. Thomas Jefferson, in fact, says in a letter to John Adams that Americans will learn everything they need to know in their mom's womb. He says this kind of facetiously, but he's talking about the general feeling behind this new start that was had, and that we didn't have to follow a strict form of education, a particular looking back at Greek language and then Latin, and then you would take a certain stage of learning at a particular age. This was, you know, very much an open source educational project. Now, there were parts of the country that would try to create little systematic normal schools or common schools where somebody down the road would be really verbose in a certain kind of art or thinking or mathematics. And this would be the person that would teach the children in that area because they happen to know the knowledge necessary to do so. But there was also this idea of the uncultivated land that was out there and the farming that was going to be necessary to create the resources to sustain a growing population and this westward expansion. The purposes of bringing the United States back into the classical or liberal education structure was to foster a sense of commonwealth of humanity. That was the real goal, was to try to bring the United States back into the world that participated in this larger tradition still very much to this day. The bachelor's degree and the master's degree in the higher education at Oxford has been viewed as the pinnacle of higher learning. Late 1800s to the early 1900s, there was a reevaluation of the education that was being provided to the American people. People overseas were involved in this. They were trying to foster a transatlantic community that could perpetuate itself. And in doing so, they felt that classical learning or classical education could be and had been throughout history that mechanism. And individuals within these groups that were attempting these educational overthrows in the United States said that Thomas Jefferson was illogical and insensible for believing that they could do this without a unitary form of education. And they just didn't believe that that was the case. They believed that we had innate human reason and innate abilities to come to our own conclusions, and that the only thing needed to restrain a population was law, because it didn't matter what you believed, but if you commit a crime that is against a agreed upon law, that you weren't going to reason your way out of it. This was a country in which innovation was respected, and scientific innovation was at its earliest point, where they were thinking that anything is possible. And putting somebody on a ubiquitous literature-based education, where you're just repeating somebody's rhetorical nonsense and their versions of beauty and their versions of intellect as if it is the end-all be-all of the day, wasn't seen as how you would create a country, how you would create a strong unity. The way to do that would be in creating these decentralized notions of freedom.
Right. So, you know, there's a lot of talk, rightly, about the dumbing down of the American people, but oftentimes that is kind of conflated with this idea that the trivium has, or the liberal arts, let's just say, have been removed from the education of the common people. Now, of course, in the Middle Ages, it's true that the general population was not schooled in the liberal arts. However, the whole population was subjected to a liberal arts system. That is, within the logic of the liberal arts system, only a small minority of people at the top were actually given the liberal education, whereas the people beneath them were given the servile education. So these would be the economic class. These would be the producers. This is, of course, in Plato's Republic, where the vast majority of the people are the economic class, and they work and do whatever, and only a small crust at the very top of the society, the so-called philosopher kings, these are the ones who are given the education in the quote-unquote liberal subjects, these great highfalutin abstract things that the Enlightenment people were in general saying, well, we don't really need to deal in abstractions when we can deal in particulars right here, right now. So now, however, and you know, with being subjected to a reintroduced liberal arts system does not mean that the average person is given that, like, quote unquote, liberal education that might be reserved for someone at an elite school or something. You know, however, I think, and you could correct me on this, I think that the elite education in this country, as it's been reintroduced by way of this Anglo-American establishment, the sort of education that they're being given isn't necessarily in, you know, like, for instance, the quadrivium. You know, someone's going to learn about mathematics and astronomy and stuff. Like, I don't really think that an FDR is learning all that much about astronomy. What the new liberal arts structure relies upon are the elites being taught, being given that civic education that would have been the thing that the average American should have. You know, we should, because part of this American ideology is that our system should be simple enough that everyone can just get it, because it's not based on all these, like, you know, gradations of who's better than who. It's just like, here's the law and that's it. But now the average person is so disenfranchised from what's actually going on in Washington or their state government that, you know, that's politician stuff, and we hate them. Generally speaking, Americans aren't fond of politicians. And so the people who are in the political class, they're receiving this philosophy of government, whereas the average person probably isn't. However, there's still a cultural ubiquity that is instilled in the American public as a function of the technology that we have. So whereas incumbent in the liberal system is this idea that we're all being given a literarily homogenous culture where we can all refer back to the great conversation. And as you've said in past interviews, where, you know, the goal of the liberally educated person is to speak like Cicero and to, you know, all these things, to adopt the grammar of Donatus or whoever. You know, we can refer to, if I want to talk about some great philosophical thing, if I'm a liberally educated person, the thing to do isn't to come up with my own answer to a question. It's to quote some ancient or medieval philosopher or something, because that's a marker of my intelligence, if I can quote somebody else's answer to a new question. So the average person, however, in this country right now, they don't really have that. We all know that Americans today, anyway, don't particularly read all that much. However, what they do, and where this cultural ubiquity does come in, they can refer to movies and they can refer to TV. And that's the cultural uniformity that exists right now, where, sure, like, my dad isn't going to refer to Homer, but he can refer, and he could speak to people in his generation about things they hold in common that they saw on television. They could, oh, remember this? Oh, remember fucking Archie Bunker? You know, like, that could be a lens through which people relate. And that's just a function of technology. So,
of rhetoric. Yeah.
Of rhetoric.
Yeah. Of rhetoric as technology. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, I don't want to get too far away from the point about how the liberal arts are reintroduced, but I just want people to understand that just because the average person isn't reading Plato and Aristotle and Thomas Hobbes, we all tend to watch the same cultural events through the same lens. We all tend to see it through the same thing, on the same medium. And maybe the internet is doing a little bit to decentralize that, and as more people kind of retreat into their own ideological spaces, which, of course, that could be a problem too. But equally problematic is this idea of a cultural ubiquity where there's one station and that's where we get all of the news from in a sort of objective way, when, of course, the idea that any source is going to be purely objective is just lunacy. But of course, a lot of people have that and entertain that illusion. But every news source says it's unbiased. So come on. But anyway, yeah, I just want to point out that even though the average American's probably not reading the quote unquote great works, they are observing something in common. There is a cultural ubiquity that makes us all Americans, because we all remember certain things. We all share certain cultural markers. And this is something for people to rally behind. So 9/11 is a really good example where, you know, everyone rallied behind the flag, and, you know, then it wasn't long until people who had nothing to do with that attack were being bombed and scorched in their homes and stuff. So, you know, unity isn't always a good thing. And the television, the radio, these things have been technologies of, that have unified Americans for the past 100 years. Well, radio 100 years, television about half that. But I think you get where I'm going with this.
Yes.
So I'll throw it back to you. We could talk a little more about this.
These are forms of rhetoric. Television is itself a form of rhetoric. It's never to say that all technology is bad one way or the other. It can be used to liberate or it can be used to conquer. These new mediums have taken over print culture and print media, where you have, you know, kind of a divide where some people get their news and little sound bites from a couple different news sources, and others read white papers on it from some of the most well-known foreign policy associations and are closer to the actual conversation. It's not a surprise to me that there are cybernetic journals named the Trivium Journal of Cybernetics and things like that, because they're, and I once coined a word during the John Taylor Gatto discussions, Trivenetics, which was a combination of cybernetics and the Trivium. Because when you realize the history of liberal education as a techne and as a systematic form of education meant to do a specific thing, and the conception of that, how that's been carried on, with a lot of nuance there, of course, you see that it's really the same thing.
This is what Marshall McLuhan spent his career doing. He wrote his doctoral thesis at the University of Cambridge under I.A. Richards, the co-creator of Basic English, future Harvard Red Book collaborator, Trivium advocate, and member of the Macy conferences on cybernetics. And McLuhan's thesis at Cambridge was on the Trivium in the place of Thomas Nash.
The ways in which this educational curricula or medium had perpetuated over time, and how one could use it as a way to have a leg up on culture and society. It's no surprise that T.H. Huxley says there is no better way towards culture than the old Trivium and Quadrivium of the medieval universities. The Trivium can be looked at in many different ways. At its base, it is a tool simply to teach you how to read and write. That's it. In Latin, in Greek. The word Trivium didn't exist, as we know, until the early to mid 700s, when Alcuin of York and one of his proteges coined the term to denote grammar, logic, and rhetoric. The grammar, logic, and rhetoric being a part of a larger system of 10 or 11 arts that were never meant to be one set ubiquity. The most important thing to point out is that at its base, the liberal education going back to Isocrates was an insular aristocratic system of civic education. It was how to teach civic humanism to people in the elite classes, how you could get a king, a wealthy person in society, to be able to speak in such a way that he appeared to be representing the people. So it was a strategy of rhetorical creation. This was the purpose of the Trivium. It wasn't meant for imparting in its first form critical thinking. What it was is a way in which you could speak for a polity. Now, so in Greece and Rome, you're dealing with a situation in which you had citizens of the polis, which were the ones that were speaking for the polis and developed this rhetorical education. And then you had slaves outside of that. So in the former, in Greece and Rome, the former were citizens, and the medievalists were not. The medievalists did not have a polis. There was no polis during this period of time. There was a Christian clerisy that held all of the knowledge that then created insular sometimes secretive sects that would learn this knowledge and then get to perpetuate Christian unity to other people. We're talking about the monastic orders, the friars and such. They would go out and find parishioners and create circulars or encyclicals for different political organizations. So the medievalists had no polis, and the Renaissance was really just a rediscovering or reapplication of this form of civic humanism. But this was not the education that was meant to educate Americans. And I'm going to read a passage from Terrence Moore from a paper called Limits of the Trivium. There's a lot to get into here as far as the who and why and when, which if you want to make a placeholder there for William Torrey Harris, we can talk about him in a second because it's most important. In this paper called The Limits of the Trivium, it was Terrence Moore's attempt. He's of Hillsdale Educational Institution. His attempt to point out the fallacies of Dorothy Sayers' Lost Tools of Learning. And in this, he says that the account of the trivium might itself first seem like a useless exercise in professional pedantry, yet there is more important things behind this story. The ancients and the medievalists had this fundamental difference. The former were citizens and the latter were not. The ancients owed their understanding of life and consequently of education to the polis or to the res publica, which we talked about in the discussion of Isocrates. The medievalists had no polis. The Renaissance was then not just a rejection of the medieval style of education, but it was a return to the civic humanism of the ancient world, and the education systems at the time followed suit. What do we not find in the trivium and the quadrivium? We don't find history, government, or economics, which had not even been invented yet, and ethics, the very disciplines that are central to the ancient and later to the Enlightenment efforts to live a good and happy life in society. We don't find poetry or art either, though music is in there, and a lot of that is left out. I would recommend that people check out my History of the Trivium with Richard Grove from 2013. And in particular, if you want to get started on this from a ground-up level, check out the Realm of Isocrates podcast that Daniel and I recorded a few weeks back, because I think this really gets to the heart of the purposes of liberal education. Now, anytime we have these kind of conversations, it's always going to be hard for people to not see that we're talking about a large amount of nuance, not trying to make universal statements. That's part of the problem of liberal education itself. There are periods of time in which liberal education means a very different thing. There are also different times of liberal education, which you have an oratorical tradition, and then you have a philosophical tradition. And then you have a whole of history that is misinterpreted where we even got these ideas from. So we have to understand, you have to look at it through a set of different lenses. You can look at it in a first person lens. You can look at it in a second person lens and a third person lens. But really looking at it objectively is in the ability to stand outside of all of that and realize that human reason is something that is innate to all human beings, not just somebody from the Western culture, not just somebody who has learned the literary humaniores, not somebody that has just learned through these traditions. There is an intrinsic value in what used to just be called barbarian cultures. I mean, hell, half of our knowledge of mathematics wouldn't be what it was unless the Muslim cultures hadn't preserved it, correct? And so we have to be humble to realize that these earlier models can be valuable to people. Earlier models of classical education. Of course, you want to learn what somebody said at the time because we don't have a transcription of history from what was going on then. What we have is a bunch of myths and poets and stories and one-sided views and things that we have to sort through. But in this country, the only unifying factor that was necessary was law. This was not meant to be surrounded upon language. Yes, they wanted to create an American English, but they just as much respected French and German and Austrian and Russian and Turkoman and all kinds of different places around the world. And that knowledge could come from even the Native Americans. Thomas Jefferson himself gathered treasure chests of different dialects that he thought were going to get lost, and that it would be a loss to all of human history to not try to determine where these original dialects and languages came from that these natives had, rather than viewing them as strictly barbarians. Now, can have a whole nother conversation about the hypocrisies of these people's actions and manifest destiny and all of this stuff. But there are these instances in which they recognize the intrinsic value of the Native American cultures and how they needed to be preserved if we were ever to have a cogent look at what our history is. Whereas imperial thought is, it doesn't matter, we're never going to know. Let's just tell them this one myth and they'll believe it for a long time. And then we'll just tell them another myth when they realize that that's not true. You'll get a Copernicus or a Galileo or a Thomas Jefferson or a Ben Franklin or somebody that comes along and throws off the whole of history by showing a scientific reality that makes all the other ones null and void. And then, of course, the religious progenitors will come along and say, well, of course, electricity, because God or whatever. You will not find anything in the Founding Fathers in which they're extolling the trivium and quadrivium as the end all of all education. The closest you'll find is John Quincy Adams referencing it in one paper. You'll find John Adams referencing general education as necessary, which any polity is going to realize that. And you have to have a way to perpetuate what the reasoning for the American Revolution was. Otherwise, somebody's going to come along with a copy of the United States Constitution and try to undo it. And that was the goal of the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable Project. I was introduced to Tragedy and Hope and Carol Quigley's work through radio presenters years ago, back in the late 90s. I didn't ever really get to look into Tragedy and Hope and the history of why it was important and who Carol Quigley was until really after 9/11. I was aware of it. I had listened to podcasts on it. I knew the general, you know, spot pieces that people always hold up as the importance behind it. But I think what's neglected from his work is the cultural aspects of that. And so what I went looking for was to see if Carol Quigley's work could be substantiated, because he's one of these authors that in a couple of his books, he doesn't like extensively footnote it, because he's getting a lot of this information directly from the records of the Council on Foreign Relations, a Royal Institute of International Affairs, and these internationalist projects. The purpose of the reintroduction of the Trivium into the United States was really an attempt to get everybody back on the same page, to bring everybody back into the idea of a commonwealth, and to restructure the purposes of a federal society. And that's why this was being done. It's not something that you can just say, we're going to reintroduce the Trivium and it's going to have this effect and that's going to be the thing, because that's never what it's about. That's the medium. And the message is really this particular kind of grace, a particular kind of individual, a particular kind of gentleman. And the Rhodes scholarships were created directly for this purpose. And I know I've talked about this on some other shows, but somebody might be hearing this new, so I'll give a little bit of a summary. Cecil Rhodes, in the late 1800s, became a Freemason. He decided that Freemasonry was not up to the challenge of securing the British polity, the notion of British Empire or British Commonwealth. And he left all of his money to the Secretary of State of England at the time to fulfill the purpose of a new secret society that would do better at what Freemasonry was not good at. The guy he left his money to, he was the Secretary of State at the time, and he says that wherever the Hut of Settlement landed, there closely after is the Hut of the Freemasonic apparatus. His name is Lord Carnarvon. And this is the guy who was the Secretary of the Colonies at the time, and that Cecil Rhodes said he wanted to leave his last will and testament and all the money to him and to Nathan Rothschild, but originally to the Secretary of State of the Colonies. And that guy was the Grand Master of Freemasonry at the time. So it would leave no doubt that he knows what he's talking about. He's the Grand Master of the Lodge, Grand Lodge of England of Freemasonry at the time, and he's the Secretary of Colonies, and he's saying that that's what Freemasonry was for, was to secure the empire, kind of like a cybernetic feedback mechanism to create a secret culture inside of a open culture that would maintain a aristocracy, a monarchy, or an oligarchy. They don't care. The liberal education doesn't care. He didn't care. Cecil Rhodes says in his Last Will and Testament, in this Confession of Faith document, which is his first attempt at the Last Will and Testament, said he wanted to create a college underneath a guy by the name of John Robert Seeley. John Robert Seeley is one of the most well-known historians of the Victorian age. And he wrote a book called The Expansion of Empire, which was using Isocrates' notion of rhetorical creation and the attempts at solving the problems of universals to create, quote unquote, Greater Britain. Greater Britain was to be a new polity creation that people would adopt to view the expansion of the empire. The book was called The Expansion of the Empire. It's one of the most popular books that he wrote. He also wrote a book called The Life and Times of Stein. And in The Life and Times of Stein, he is discussing how Johann Fichte had used the concept of Bildung, or self-cultivation, within the liberal arts educational tradition to create compulsory education for the Prussians after the Battle of Jena in 1806. And you can imagine my surprise, because I heard all this stuff from John Taylor Gatto, but I never heard anything about John Robert Seeley. But what specifically Cecil Rhodes was doing was attempting to leave money for the creation of a college for the, quote, English-speaking idea of John Robert Seeley. And Carol Quigley said nothing of this. So I said, man, I've got something here I got to look for. Got to see what this English-speaking idea is of John Robert Seeley. And it just so happens at the same time that I was looking into this information that we had been introduced by this other individual on the internet that contacted us out of the blue and wanted to talk about this idea of the Trivium via Dorothy Sayers and this lost tools of learning, this, ooh, we've had our critical thinking stolen from us. That's why Americans are stupid and we're not in line with the world and we're not as smart. You know, this is what the idea was that Dorothy Sayers was perpetuating. And I don't want to go down the Dorothy Sayers route because we're still in the late 1800s. But she's not an honest broker either. But John Robert Seeley viewed the Americans as having achieved something that nobody else had been able to achieve, meaning that all the ancient aristocracies that I just talked about with John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and these other people, they had been able to solve something that these others had never been able to achieve, and that they could people a land so big and still have concordance or accordance to the doctrines of the country. And that was through this massive decentralization. He believed King George III was the worst king, and if he hadn't been such a bad leader, and Cecil Rhodes said the same thing, that we would have been holding parliament in New York and London every other year. And they sought to reverse this, and they wanted to create this concept of Greater Britain and the ideas of the British Commonwealth. So they changed the name of the British Empire, rather, to the Commonwealth. And this was all at the same time that they were trying to change the educational structures. And the English-speaking idea that Cecil Rhodes wanted to leave his money to was elucidated in a passage from a book called Lectures and Essays, which was a compilation of essays and lectures that he'd given, one of which was English in schools. And what he said at the time was that they had done too far in perpetuating the language of Greece and Rome in Greek and Latin. And they wanted to move this off into a system of higher education. They wanted to make it to where if you advance past the age of 14, that is when you would learn Latin and Greek. They would teach English to the people instead of Latin and Greek, and to their own within society. If they continued to perpetuate Ovid, then everybody would forget about William Shakespeare and more contemporary English representatives of culture. So it was a cultural creation project. They believed that they needed to create an English trivium and use that as a model in which to manage polities around the world. They were very much looking back at the Greek Commonwealth and the problems of Isocrates and the funeral oration of Pericles as models for creating a new type of union. During ancient Greece, there were all these different kinds of unions like the Delian League and others, and they were using this kind of model to create a union of South Africa, in which they would use propaganda, a common literature, through the creation of think tanks like the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Roundtable Journal of Commonwealth Affairs in particular. They wanted to use this and Seeley's idea as a way to perpetuate a new culture. Seeley, Cecil Rhodes' guy, dies before he can get this done. He wanted to have a school set up. They could make the trivium the basis of all of their secret society, because he said he wanted to base it on the Jesuits. Now, the Jesuits' education system, it's called the Ratio Studiorum. That is what I just told you the Americans threw off, because they said they had no unitary Ratio Studiorum. And you look at what the Ratio Unitary Studiorum is, that is Loyola's attempt at appropriating Erasmus's education from the Renaissance to the Jesuits. And it's based on the trivium and the quadrivium, just as the Studium Generale that led the medieval universities was based on as well. And so when Cecil Rhodes very consciously says, I want to create a secret society based on the Jesuits, based on the idea and organizational structure of the Jesuits, he's saying, okay, they've got an organizational structure of a bunch of orders and cardinals that go out and do the things they do. I want to imitate that. And then they use this education system of the Ratio Studiorum, which is a unitary education where it's collectivism, where individualism is not to be tolerated. And you learn along this line of the trivium and the quadrivium and this appropriation of civic humanism to the Roman Catholic polity. He wanted to copy that idea, create an education system and create a system of cardinals that would go out and do the things for him, that would get this done, that would achieve it. One of the main people that followed this idea and became a member of the Rhodes Roundtable Group was Alfred Zimmern. He was a medievalist and a classicist who was perpetuating the ideas of the Greek Commonwealth. He wrote one of the Bibles for the Roundtable movement called the Greek Commonwealth. And this was all based on looking at the problems of unity in ancient Greece. And one of their heroes at the time is Edward Gibbon, who is a historian and philosopher. He wrote The Decline and History of the Roman Empire, which was one of Cecil Rhodes' favorite books, by the way. What Gibbon determined why Rome ultimately falls is because a decline in civic humanism, this liberal education that creates civic humanism, an insular kind of polity that can extend all the way out to everybody. Depending on the type of polity that you have, you have a different adherence to it. But this was very much based in the idea of a clerisy a intellectual elite that would hoard this type of knowledge as a means of having the best information. You know, these think tanks were thought to be a bank of information, a repository of information on the rest of the world. And in private letters between Lionel Curtis and Philip Kerr Lardlothian, who were two of the main collaborators in the Rhodes-Milner secret society plot, that if we have been able to go further than Seeley, it's only because of the technology that we had that allowed us to do so. And the fact that we went out to these individual countries and dealt with them directly and presented the problems to them in a practical manner and brought them into international relations. They used the Trivium as a cultural creation tool to then create disciplines from. And this is where the discipline of international relations comes from. Rhodes himself said he wanted to use a copy of the United States Constitution in order to bring the United States back into the empire. They did so by taking Alexander Hamilton's look at the federal problem and applying it to the problems they had in South Africa. Now, the American founders were very fond of using Greek and Roman terms to write anonymously in papers. Some of them were Publius and some of them were others. They always resisted using Pericles. John Adams himself spoke out against Pericles, and Jefferson inquired on him as well with John Adams. And all of them refused to use Pericles. The only one that used Pericles was Alexander Hamilton. And that was after a certain period of time. He had spoke poorly of Pericles as well. But when you read Carol Quigley's works, Tragedy and Hope, you find that their entire project is based in this funeral oration of Pericles and the larger problem of Pan-Hellenism. It wasn't as much in the minutiae as much as it was in the attempts at creating a ubiquitous polity. And that's the problem they had at the time. The problem they had at the time was that the British Empire was being viewed negatively. They were trying to bring India into the empire, but they didn't want it to really have the representation that it would based on population number. So they started creating all these other half-hearted attempts to maintain power. They said, okay, India, you've got millions and millions of people. What we're going to do is we're going to create a system of diarchy where you'll have two rulers that you'll vote for, and then those will be your representatives in the parliament. Rather than saying, well, per million people, you're supposed to have this amount of representation, that would have given India way more power in the British Parliament than they ever wanted them to have. They didn't want them there at all. They just wanted to subordinate them. So they created, like Lionel Curtis created, the system of diarchy. And Lionel Curtis is the same person that writes the book Civitas Dei on how to create the kingdom of God on earth, a world civic humanism. They realized they were never going to get that out to everybody. So what they did was they created the Rhodes Scholarships, and the Rhodes Scholarships were intended to take two students from every state in the country, more than any other country around the world, mind you, the best and the brightest, and they would send them over to England. And at the time, the main thing that they would learn was Latin and Greek literae humanores, which was the literature humanities, which is the basis of the medieval university that the Rhodes Scholarships were meant to mimic. And they thought that this would create a certain type of individual. John Taylor Gatto is an educator who taught for over 30 years within the public education system. And what he prized was open source learning. Rather than following the Bloom's taxonomy or the Carnegie credit system of his time, which were essentially the common core of today, the idea that there needs to be a ubiquity and standards for everybody that they have to learn, and that we don't have, you know, something in us and ourselves that we want to explore. We can only find it within these, you know, set occupations that we can go get jobs for and take out loans for and all this stuff. He was against that. So if he had students in his class that were just about comic books and that's all they cared about, he would say, I'm going to ask your parents if it's okay if you take some days off and go study comic books and go learn the techniques and things and see if that's what you want to do. Or somebody else who was all they cared about was swimming. Okay, go learn the depth and length of every pool and the buoyancy and the, you know, put it all into a book and you have something for yourself. So he was all about like the opposite of the Trivium. The only reason that he was asked about the Trivium in the Ultimate History lesson was because Richard and I and others had just been introduced to this idea of the Lost Tools of Learning by Dorothy Sayers, who John Taylor Gatto knew about as a writer of detective novels and things like that, but he took the papers we gave him, went back to the hotel and studied them, and then came back and talked just like he would as if he was some other place that they asked him about something and he thought he should know about it. But you'll never find in John Taylor Gatto's works where he's saying that the Prussian education system overtook liberal education and that's the thing that was lost and all of that. No, you won't find anywhere in his work in which he's doing that. What you do find is that he's constantly going after the people that instituted the Trivium in the United States. And he talks about this ominous continuity, which is the Trivium. And I discussed this with him in many emails back and forth, in which I distilled the characteristics of the Oxford gentleman from the introduction of the Rhodes Scholarships into the United States by a guy by the name of William Torrey Harris. He was the first commissioner of education. But before that, he was the founder of the St. Louis Philosophical Society, which imported the first translation of the first grammar of the Western world into the United States, of Dionysius Thrace. He was also somebody who believed 99% of people were automatons, perfectly happy to carry on with whatever it is they were taught and never stepping outside of that, and that there was only really a 1% that would ever rise and seek power or seek some kind of preeminence. But it wasn't that simple. He believed there was a process in which this education needed to be imparted to people. The Trivium was never missing from American education. We had grammar, logic, and rhetoric in the stages of learning. In grammar school, intermediate school, and finishing school or high school, this is the Trivium. And John Taylor Gatto's main argument against compulsory education, that I think is consistent with not only my private conversations, but his public works, is that the artificial extension of childhood is the problem. You know, there is no hidden Western cultural device. We all have an innate ability to work within our surroundings. We're a part of this creation. And this is what education seeks to obscure, that we are all a part of this process of creation and regeneration. And they don't want everybody to know that because it would lead to, well, he thinks it would lead to a kind of destructive anarchy or destructive agnosticism. And so we need this public system that presents itself as authority, where only like the 1% are going to realize the open secret of the universe, is what he called it, the open secret of the universe. And he's referring to a poem about the beautiful snake and the lily by Goethe. One of the people that John Taylor Gatto talks about in both Dumbing Us Down, Weapons of Mass Instruction, and The Underground History of American Education is William Torrey Harris. He created the first philosophical journal that ever existed in the United States, which he created with a Prussian soldier. One of the groups that was most responsible for importing Hegel's works as well as Fichte's works into the United States. I don't want to go into all of that here today, so I just recommend that people check out my paper, William Torrey Harris, Mass Schooling and the Open Secret of the Universe. And this will give you the entire background on what I believe is the secret of Freemasonry, quote unquote, but it's also the secret of public education. And that is the speculative nature of all of it. It's a obscuring of what should be inherent knowledge to all of us because it is our, quote, birthright, as Gatto said. Between the 1890s and like 1910, there was a second American Revolution and we lost. And it was by a force of organizational knowledge that the British were able to accomplish this. And the organizational knowledge that they used to accomplish this, was all of this stuff. William Torrey Harris becomes the first commissioner of education. He introduces a paper called Oxford University and the Rhodes Scholarships, and in which he says that Oxford University is the last vestige of medieval education. He says also that the American people, as well as the American elite, the ambassadors and those that are appointed to the State Department and such, are woefully uneducated and that they are basically yahoos that don't know anything about the world. We don't know anything about the tradition because that was by design. We got rid of all that stuff. We said it wasn't the end all be all of civilization. Yeah, we'll look into it, but we got our own ideas with practical reality going on here. He wrote this paper that gets given as a speech, and he says that Oxford is the last vestige of the Trivium, that the literature humanoris education of the Rhodes Scholarships, which was the main primary course that people were to take. It was very different than colleges in the United States in that you would go there and be underneath a preceptor. You would have kind of a monitorial education over top of you the whole time. You lived in the dorm. Your teachers lived nearby. You lived with the other students. You had your adjunct helper. And you went to like people like A.G.P. Taylor, who was a classicist, who was the person administrating the Rhodes Scholarships at the time. From this, I distilled the characteristics of the Oxford gentleman. what is to be produced by liberal education. And this is true today. This is true in his time, and this is true in Isocrates' time. And the characteristics of the Oxford gentleman would not exist in this form without John Taylor Gatto, because when I was discussing with him on the history of the Trivium, both in person when Richard and Lisa and I would go to New York City to help him after his multiple strokes, he would say to me, you know, Kevin, who's responsible for the resurgence of the Trivium? What's Dorothy Sayers up to? What did Thomas Jefferson say have to say about that? Because I had all these conversations with him. I would show him the artifacts of Thomas Jefferson rejecting the Trivium at William and Mary, and show him Thomas Paine's rejection of the semantic universal argument. And he was so ecstatic by this that he said, you know, this is John's genius, because the way he taught people was to get them to see their own innate abilities. And rather than say to me, like, you know, send me that paper and I'll put this thing together, what he said to me was, hey, I got some friends that'll pay you, and I can, if you'll distill these things into a list for me, I'll contact these guys and, you know, we'll get it published. And because he found it that valuable. I paraphrased very little of this. This comes from William Torrey Harris's own words. And he says, the characteristics of an Oxford gentleman are as follows. A gentleman is a product. He is made through a process of character modification. He's somebody that is made, producing a certain kind of knower, a product. A gentleman acquires a self-possession and self-respect, which commands the respect of his fellows. A gentleman possesses an inherited refinement and a common stock of literature. A gentleman has inimitable charm and assumes nothing for himself. A gentleman represses the vulgar desire to attract attention to himself. A gentleman has a sense of honor that never permits himself to think of his own rank or station. A gentleman, quote, suppresses all manifestations of the pride of aristocracy. A gentleman never mentions his titles or the influences of his family or his wealth or his literary productions or any of his services, of his ration, or of his fellow man. A gentleman avoids, quote, ostentation in his clothing, in his belongings, and in his manner toward people not wealthy. A gentleman is trained to have a proper sense of control and self-control. A gentleman can hold his tongue under severe restraint and without appearance of restraint. A gentleman cannot be pushed off his feet by an attack directed upon the weaknesses of his personality. A gentleman possesses good form and a timeless code of etiquette, which gives precedence in a certain fixed order to the members of nobility, to the dignitaries of the national church, and to the elected and appointed representatives of the English commonality, settling in advance the rank due in each order and all ceremonials. A gentleman recognizes his fixed rank and position as a courtesy when addressing letters, allusions in speech, or in written communication. It is good English form to observe the code of limitations on each of the classes of people, the nobleman or other gentleman, the tradesman, the servant, or the common laborer. So they will display proper manners and etiquette toward their superiors. The most refined gentleman will not himself make a personal matter of the neglect of courtesy, but the class to which he belongs or moves will take care of this matter on his behalf. A gentleman acts in the interest and rhetoric of a common humanity. That is the key. For those of you that listened to our last podcast, a gentleman acts in the interest and rhetoric of a common humanity and a service to fellow man. A gentleman possesses an imperturbable self-respect, which entrenches itself on a humane basis that not only easily captivates all classes of British citizens, but makes an easy conquest of a citizen of any other nationality in the world. A gentleman is, quote, the simplest of all men, but it is a simplicity with the wisdom of a serpent coiled up within it and thoroughly under control. And this is from Oxford University and the Rhodes Scholarships by William Torrey Harris, United States Commissioner of Education, and it was printed in the Addresses and Proceedings of the Annual Meeting of the National Education Association in 1903. I believe it said Progressive Association, but it's the National Education Association of 1903. And this perfectly lays out what the purposes of a liberal education were to be. And it is directly in line with the artificial attempts at unity or the whatever works kind of mentality in creating a educated type of being, a person for the meritocracy. And it goes on to say a lot more in this. And I've got a follow-up chapter which shows how cohorts of Rhodes and Lionel Curtis and others said that the Rhodes scholarships were set up along lines laid down directly by Oxford when they set out to create the colonies themselves. And I've already shown and can illustrate in triplicate that Harvard, Yale, and Princeton were all based on this classical model of the trivium and the quadrivium and the later attempts to bring that in. Whether that be through the General Education in a Free Society, which was called the Harvard Red Book of I.A. Richards, and the philosophical attempts at creating a universal language of basic English, which was created by C.K. Ogden and I.A. Richards, and was being perpetuated by the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable Group, where they wanted to create a 850-word language structure called Basic English, okay, Windows 95 for the rest of the world, a ubiquitous basic structure that could open up China to commerce, or that could be the basis for the basic language in Star Wars. Go look it up. It's all based in this idea of trying to have the lowest common denominator of coherence. But new criticism of I.A. Richards was based in a similar thing. And this is where cybernetics comes in with the logical positivists and those at the Vienna Circle, Ludwig Wittgenstein, and then his influence on Norbert Wiener.
And Heinz von Forster, the creator of second-order cybernetics.
A whole nother conversation would be amazing to have. But I.A. Richards, who came to Harvard and said he wanted to reinstitute the trivium, said that national language had taken too much preeminence, and that the solution to that was the reintroduction of the literature, humanities, and the trivium, and how to read a page, how to read a book, Mortimer Adler, and how to read a page, I.A. Richards. But it wasn't just them. Dorothy Sayers. We could do an entire show, and should, probably, on Dorothy Sayers and the Koinonia and the idea of the Christian clerisy that was set up by the Moot and J.H. Oldham and the Rhodes Roundtable Group, and how it was all in homage to Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, where the sea captain who kills the bird, gets the albatross around his neck or whatever, said to have three individuals that are meant to represent the trivium, grammar, logic, rhetoric within that. But I lost that reference about 6 years ago and I can't find it. I know it's in my head and I know it exists. So Dorothy Sayers was a fictional writer. She was a very odd person for society at the time. Women were not usually respected in literary circles. And she's somebody that was working with the Fabians, working with the coefficients, working with J.H. Oldham, T.S. Eliot, and others in trying to solve the problems of Christianity at the time and the secularization of the arts, which she saw as the biggest problem in the world. And she was a member from 1937 to 1947 of the Moot, which was in homage to the Rhodes Roundtable Group. The Rhodes Roundtable Group used to meet at Place Neuwied and some of these other castles and locations, and they would have what they called moots, where they would get together and discuss these ideas, and they would trade eggs, eggs and moots. Eggs were unpublished books that they didn't want anybody else to read that would then be refined into a publishable version of that book that was the actual rhetoric they wanted people to read. But if you could actually get a hold of some of these eggs, you find that they contain information that the others don't. And they were just, you know, papers and books that were just meant for people on the inside. Dorothy Sayers becomes a member in 1937 of this group called the Moot, which was created by J.H. Oldham. J.H. Oldham was the guy that the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable hired to go to South Africa and help with the unification of South Africa. He was also a very religious man. He worked with like Tansley and Jan Christian Smuts and those that created the concept of holism, which is not divorced at all from this conversation, because holism is just basically an artificial unity created to perpetuate whatever they wanted to accomplish in the first place through organic unity as a strategy, which I've also written a paper on my website. But Dorothy Sayers was a member of this group, and what they were trying to do, they believed themselves to be the legacy of Samuel Taylor Coleridge and his idea of a Christian clerisy. Now, the Christian clerisy idea goes all the way back to the people that Isocrates was educating, or the different groups under Plato. You can place it a lot of different places because these are general ideas of creating an aristocratic elite that would make decisions for the whole of culture. Because the problem of universals applied to politics is that you can't have these types of unity unless you actually have this type of insular elite. This is what they sought to do. They viewed the liberal arts as having been distorted by sociology and psychology and science and all these new ideas that were coming online and ways of looking at the world. Whereas what is sociology and psychology? They're like a third party stepping outside of the system kind of thing. But Neoplatonism and a lot of mystical theosophical ideas had been fused with Christian thinking. And then on the other side of that, fused with scientific thinking for like a long time in that period. And she saw this as a problem, especially in her institutions. She was in debt to John Henry Newman, one of the bishop of the Church of England. And Cecil Rhodes actually left him as one of the people in his will as well, but he died. She saw introducing liberal education as a way to secularize Christian aesthetics. And if anybody wants to question me on that, go get a book called Our Culture, Towards a Christian Aesthetic by Dorothy Sayers, in which she lays out how they need to secularize Christian values. And at the same time that she's doing this, at the end of this project of the moot, she writes this paper called The Lost Tools of Learning, which is in 1947. She gives this at like some kind of a summer school academy as a speech. At the same time this is happening, this is when they're discovering the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so like The Lost Tools of Learning makes a lot of sense if you want it to sound esoteric and something that was lost, especially when they're discovering all this stuff that might reorganize the way you look at the Bible. And it's some Indiana Jones type stuff, as I've said before. So she names it The Lost Tools of Learning. And she says that we've lost the medieval trivium, and the medieval trivium was just this, way of critical thinking that da 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 da. And it was all bullshit. I hate to say it that way, but it was just bullshit. She makes up these different levels of the poll parrot, different stages of when she thinks learning is appropriate. She believes that you can only learn this at a certain age. You can only learn this at a certain age. You can only learn this at a certain age. And she believes that critical thinking as a result is just totally gone. Now, the scientific method, did a long way away with a literature, a way of studying literature and coming about critical thinking, because you could scientifically verify a lot of the things that you were trying to do philosophically. Which is a problem for her, because she saw this as a way that Christianity was going to die, and that the only way that she could push this is to secularize it. So she takes this Christian logos idea, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, and appropriates it to critical thinking within the trivium and sells that as an idea. And I doubt she thought it was going to get a whole lot of pub. She wrote a book called Our Mysterious English, which got way more pub than this. She even got to come speak at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And in that, she says Americans have sing-songy speech and that are basically like bastardizing the English language, and that we should never adopt their puerilities and all this other nonsense. And she talks about how the British went around the world and conquered the world in a fit of absence of mind, which is exactly what John Robert Seeley said. Nobody cared. It was just the great pirates of Buckminster Fuller, and we just accomplished all this, and just because we had the best ideas. There is no lost history of critical thinking and reasoning because, well, we've already had that conversation in the first part of the show. Reason is innate. It is the linguistic nominalistic rejection of authority to be able to say, no, you don't give that to me. I come with that. I came straight out the box with the ability to do that. Yeah, I needed an OS from my parents. They gave me some language. And there have been studies on this kind of stuff, it would be very easy to create one, but it would involve a lot of human experimentation. It would probably be unethical. You get some people and you have them create a whole new language and they teach their kids only that language. You're creating a whole nother system within that. And who's to come along and say that kid doesn't have logic because his parents taught him a metalogical construct of what that previous language structure was or whatever. There are ways to easily explain this very grandiose idea. It's a very important idea that we have innate human reason. Whether or not you want to say that is what separates us from animals or whatever, I don't even think I'd go that far, because I've seen like dolphins do somersaults right after a person did, and I've seen elephants painting, and you could say, whatever. We can go into the whole nature versus nurture argument and all that, but like most of our domination of animals and stuff like that depends on us not having this conversation, so let's save it later. That's what it really comes down to, And so we've gone through some of those things with what a liberal education is. She said she had this Lost Tools of Learning. It wasn't just her. T.S. Eliot was a part of the same group. And I have private letters of T.S. Eliot right before the moot took place, in which Scott Buchanan, an American philosopher, was writing to T.S. Eliot and saying, hey, man, I'd really like to learn about the trivium. And T.S. Eliot says, hey, Jesuit priest guy down the road who I talk to all the time. I've got this American philosopher who wants to know about the Trivium. You want to talk to him? And how about we all get together and we have a meeting one day? And this is all in his book. It talks about it. Now, who's Scott Buchanan? Scott Buchanan is a Rhodes Scholar who was a classmate of Stringfellow Barr and Clarence Strite. And for those of you just coming to this information, the summary of that is one of the main purposes of Tragedy and Hope and why it's important to somebody like me is that there was this group of people that were trying to create a world government using the Atlantic Union, which was created by a Freemason, and then creating a subset within that called the Union Now Project. And that was being created by Clarence Strite, Scott Buchanan, Stringfellow Barr, Mortimer Adler played a role in this same group with the World Constitution Movement. It was all part of the Students for a Democratic Society. This is what Carol Quigley said was one of their main plots. The Rhodes group wanted to create a three-part world, a balance of power system based on the kind of philosophies of people like Ludwig de Hio and the unification of Prussia, because it was all based on Prussia. That's why John was hinting at a lot of the importance of the Prussian education, because it not only impacts Prussian education, but it impacts Freemasonry and other things when we start getting into Johann Fichte and the letters to Constant and how the education system of Prussia at the time mimicked what they were trying to do to buttress nation states with Freemasonry as an insular culture. And now people are just like having their mind like fall apart because they don't know what I'm talking about. But I have to get it out because we're going to talk about it later and people need to see how important this is. And furthermore, I need to get it out of my head, like, be honest with you. Dorothy Sayers was a member of this MOOT, which was a Rhodes Milner Roundtable project with Carol Quigley's source for Tragedy and Hope. Okay. Carol Quigley's source for Tragedy and Hope, Alfred Zimmern, who wrote the previously mentioned Greek Commonwealth. And he also wrote a book called The Third British Empire, which was an expansion of J.R. Seeley's expansion of empire argument. We come with the instructions to be able to achieve critical thinking. If it helps people to use the words grammar, logic, and rhetoric in order to do that, I'm not somebody that's running around telling you don't, you know, do what helps you or whatever. I wouldn't want anybody to do that to me. For me, I'm perfectly fine realizing that I have the ability to sense, I have the ability to perceive, and I have the ability to make judgments. And I am perfectly fine living in a country that doesn't make having a standard critical thinking mantra their organizing principle. And that's what this was about. Thomas Jefferson said, "I care not what anybody else thinks as long as reason is around to combat it. As long as I'm able to use my reasoning powers to try to convince you otherwise, then I don't care what you believe." Whereas these earlier systems were, this is what you believe, you get slapped on the arm if you don't say it right, you don't know the right answer, you're not in line with our thinking. Oh, God forbid you disown all of it, then you're excommunicated. You're kicked out of the Mayflower colony. You're kicked out of the Roman Catholic Church. You're kicked out of the Jesuits. You're not a part of us anymore. You're not a part of our organization. Whereas this was a system in which the founding fathers understood cybernetics sometimes better than some of those that discuss it today, because they understood that rather than creating that ubiquitous feedback mechanism that would rescind man's humanity to a point of entropy where value judgments are no longer necessary because it's all based on this authoritative education, they set up a decentralized system. Freedom above all, freedom of religion, freedom of thought. Of course, it didn't end up the way they planned. Nobody's saying that, like, some originalist conception here. This isn't some, like, yay, they did it all and here we are. No, their system got overthrown by a intellectual elite that has been managing the real conversations of international relations and politics for our elected leaders. Our elected leaders are getting bad information from people that have goals and have very specific economic and religious and political aspirations for the world in order to create a world polity. And that's what the great books of the Western world pointed to. And I can, you know, anybody who wants to call me on any of this, please do. Cause I will show you from these people's own writings, from the people that originated it. There was a goal of creating a specific type of polity and a goal of pretending that the Trivium is a critical thinking tool, whereas the guy who's responsible for its importation into the United States, even pre-Dorothy Sayers, said all of that should be done in a laboratory with the scientific method. I meant to impart no tool for critical thinking, for learning all subjects, for achieving total knowledge. I merely meant to teach how to read. That's what he said.
So it's all of this stuff, you're giving me the impression that despite the fact that the liberal arts and particularly the trivium has been presented as this tool for critical thinking, in fact, insofar as it's a tool of actually creating a culture, it seems to be more of something that puts blinders on your innate sense of critical thinking, because it imposes on the quote unquote educated person this idea of what an education is. It means you've followed this curriculum. It means you've read these authors, and it means that you're thinking about the world within this prescriptive frame that's been provided over generations and generations of so-called experts. It's been given to you. This is your cultural heritage. And so all world problems, all material problems, all abstract problems are going to have to be quote unquote solved, or at least viewed through this educated liberal lens that's been provided by these generations of learned folks. So in effect, what that is you're putting, you're ensuring that people are able, like the scholastics, to think tremendously logically within a frame, within an artificially imposed frame. And that frame itself, it's not just something that exists in a university. That frame is, in fact, that which holds the society together. It's the axiomatic foundation of a unified polity. And that is what the liberal system seeks to uphold, whereas the American rejection would be an opening up of potential and saying, well, you know, there are innumerable systems of logic or of culture that we might adopt. And so we might as well let them all flourish and kind of, you know, let the best one win out, or perhaps even new syntheses of systems will arise. But, you know, I've always had a kind of infatuation with the idea of religious syncretism and pointing out, you know, okay, similarities across religious structures around the world and through history, because I think something that's intrinsically liberatory is when you can take different systems which are presented, you know, if you're an evangelical Christian or something, like that has to be the only religion that's true, and all the other ones are separate, and you wouldn't want to mingle them together because that would corrupt your pure, true, quote unquote, Christian ideal. But me, I'm like, you know what? I like when they meld together. I like seeing how they're similar and how they're different. And to me, that's like the essence of liberty, is taking from here and taking from there and seeing if these systems can coexist or perhaps mingle. Maybe we can create an even better synthetic system, just like the Enlightenment thinkers and the scientists of the day were saying, you know what? What if we put this material together with this material? No one's ever done that before. And well, guess what? Now you just invented something new and useful. So I think the same can be done with systems. The problem with the liberal arts system as it's been presented, and certainly as it was used and is being used by these neo-imperialists, I guess, if we want to call them that, the system of the Anglo-American Empire, which says, you know, unify people based on their language. There's certainly a utility in that, and there's maybe elements of it we could agree with if we extracted them from the logic of the system. But the problem is this liberal system says you can't do that. This has to exist within the system. If we're adopting this universal polity, then you have to accept all of these other things. Just like I could say I like the disputation aspect of scholasticism. And so I personally can pull that out of the scholastic system and say, I think it's a great idea if we're going to debate something that, you know, you make your point, and then before I make mine, I should clarify that I actually know what you said. That's a great idea. The problem with the scholastics themselves was that, well, it comes as a package. And so if you're going to use disputation, well, then you have to accept the authorities of the auctors. You have to accept Cicero, Ovid, Donatus, all of these people as authorities. But I think, and perhaps it's my American spirit showing itself, but I said, I don't have to do any of that shit. I can take the disputation method and do whatever I want with it. And I think personally, so long as I'm not using it in a way that actually contradicts any, like I'm not using it in an internally contradictive way. I'm using it consistently with reality to test things and to compare and contrast ideas with each other. So long as I'm not like just blatantly making shit up, then I don't really see a problem with it. And maybe this is part of the reason why people do use it as a metaphor, although they don't always say it's a metaphor, but like the whole trivium, grammar, logic, rhetoric thing, it's used as a metaphor, like, well, the grammar's the input and the logic's the processing and rhetoric's the output. Fine. I get that. And it's a decent metaphor. But the problem is what they're doing when you use it as that metaphor is you're doing what I'm doing with the scholastic thing is you're extracting a meaning. You're rereading a new meaning into this thing and then pulling it out of the system that it came from. The problem is when people do that, often they don't see the system they're pulling it from. And they don't know that they're dragging all of this baggage along with it, with their metaphorical abstraction. That's my only issue with it. Like you said, you know, if you want to use grammar, logic, and rhetoric as benchmarks to represent certain aspects of critical thinking, rock and roll. Why not? You know, sure, let's understand our language and let's be logical and let's learn to speak and, you know, be clear and whatnot. Let's communicate effectively. But unfortunately, they have actively employed this liberal system in order to make sure that that frame of culture remains intact in order to preserve a quasi-global polity.
I think you're hitting on the most important part of it. It insinuates itself as authority when itself is really just a aesthetic of authority. I don't know if you've ever heard of the book Turn on Washington spies, the George Washington spy ring, on how they were able to anticipate troop movements and things like that, how they were using spies up north through New York and through some of the different saloons and things like that in order to get messages back to the different generals during the American Revolution. But there's an important scene in this in which the main character, Abraham, has gotten caught showing disloyalty to the crown, and the local head of the army for the British army there is living in his house, quartered in his house. And he's trying to think of how I'm going to punish this kid because he's friends with the father who's the magistrate there. And the magistrate starts saying, you know, oh, the how you could trace the book of fate and starts saying this big long thing, right? And then British soldier looks over and says, oh, magnificent. Have you taught your trivium to your son? Have you taught your trivium to your son? And Abraham, the main character who's fighting for the American Revolution, says at that time, no man is above the law. And it's just amazing, like that this cultural representation of exactly what the hell I'd been saying. And I used it as a beginning of one of my songs. I have a song that's about the trivium because I'm that kind of guy. It's called Letters to Isidore. The magistrate was trying to win over the British loyalist soldier by showing how he had this verbose remembrance of this rhetorical thing that made him sound intelligent. And all Abraham, the son who was fighting for the American Revolution, cared about was no man is above the law. He interrupted it all. Trivium doesn't matter. Throw that shit out of here. We don't need it. It just perfectly shows exactly what my entire argument was from so many years before that, how the trivium was this aesthetic cultural tool used to create a certain kind of individual where you could rhetorically speak for the people. You could have this eloquent design in that kind of a thing. And it was form over function. Whereas Abraham was concerned with function and the magistrate and the other guy were concerned with the style and the oratory behind it because he didn't care about that. And what they ultimately determined was that Abraham's punishment would be that he would write an apology publicly and it would get published and then he would get pardoned for that one occurrence if it never happened again. But it was really, really great. I may share, if you want to share that track with this episode, you can do that. I have the lyrics here as well. People are going to, you know, be interested in that kind of a thing. But it's all about the history of the trivium. Getting to that shows the point of this research and what the inherent value of the individual and intrinsic value of one's own reasoning process means to the world and to our society and to any kind of future we want to build going forward. And essentially where a lot of people are going to fall in this is going to be determined on what their ideology is. And if you really want to talk about critical thinking, you have to be able to separate that ideology. You have to be able to separate the people you believe are the nefarious ones doing the thing and actually show that that's the case. You know, otherwise you have no standing. You've just got a narrative that sounds plausible, that might draw people rhetorically to your vision, but it's not the truth, you know, and I'm concerned with the truth. When you're looking at historiography and things to make blanket conclusions, and that's the biggest challenge within any of this research. You can't really do that. You have to do it from an individual perspective. Also have to do it from a perspective of separating your ideology from the greater whole of it. If I'm looking at this from a evangelical Christian point of view, I'm going to view the loss of the Christian trivium as a terrible thing. you know? I don't view it that way. That doesn't mean I don't agree with, like, some Christian teachings and that there are morals and beliefs and things within that system that are good and a lot of others that are terrible and stoning people and awful shit. But what you're saying is the case. That's what John Taylor Gatto rested so highly on, open source education, and was open to unschooling and open to other ideologies, and even open that half of the stuff he said throughout his whole career might need questioning sometime. What I learned through a process of refinement and constantly looking at it and sorting out the contradictions and sorting out where there might be ideological aspects to it. I doubt there are many anarchists out there that should be running around saying we should all use the Trivium and create a civic humanistic society that has a government. Like, I doubt that's going to be the case. What it's for is the creation of a ubiquitous type of polity. And if you want to find the truth about things, we use the scientific method for a lot of that. And then we speculate about a lot of stuff that we're never going to know the answer to, because we don't know the supreme name giver. So if you believe in a supreme name giver that came down and gave all names to things and the word of God is the logos, that's going to be where you rest it. That's going to be where you go, you know, and that's okay, because we live in a free country where you can do that. And it still doesn't change anything. It doesn't change the governmental structure. It doesn't change anything for me. Thomas Paine thought that no great books were necessary. The only language that was necessary was the language of common sense. He literally thought that should be the grammar of future stuff. And that's where we are. There's a lot more we can discuss with regard to the introduction of the Trivium. Dorothy Sayers is not your friend. The person that introduced Dorothy Sayers' work into the United States was CIA officer by the name of William F. Buckley, who wrote the foreword to Climbing Parnassus. His whole goal was the reintroduction of Latin as the main thing for colleges, and that we had lost our great culture and we need to climb back up Parnassus and recover the great culture. He was the CIA protege of E. Howard Hunt, the guy who says that he killed Kennedy or helped kill Kennedy. So
he was also a bonesman.
Yeah, and a Skull and Bonesman, yes. And also, he's the founder of the National Review magazine, which still exists today as like a political powerhouse. And it was in the National Review in like 1954, 56, that he published The Lost Tools of Learning. To look at that date. But this one individual in the United States becomes so enamored by it that he created a bunch of classical Christian schools around it. Now our homeschooling people, some of them who praise John Taylor Gatto, are using a fallacious theory of education to buttress their classical academy that came through a CIA officer who was a protege of a guy who killed Kennedy, or says he did.
At the very least, he was a part of Watergate.
Yeah, at the very least, he's a part of Watergate. He admitted to be a Watergate burglar. He said at the end of his life that he was one of the people on the team that assassinated Kennedy. So I don't know why somebody would say that at the end of their life unless they actually did it. And it seems like you're not going to get anything out of it, you're dying. So, but that's not necessarily relevant. I'm not saying that, you know, there's a lot we could have an old other conversation about William F. Buckley and his ideology. He was a brat, you know, he like loved British culture, and he was an American who sounded like he was British. Like every time he went on a talk show, just had this like real highfalutin kind of attitude about him, that he believed that the Oxford gentleman was the zenith of society, you know, that kind of a thing. But it was because of something he published that it then spread all over the country. Classical Christian educations, that's where it spread through. And Dorothy Sayers' other works were spread in the United States by another organization, which ties into the Trivium, called the English-Speaking Union. Now, the English-Speaking Union was founded by Evelyn Wrench. Wrench was a acolyte of Cecil Rhodes and Alfred Milner and Lionel Curtis. He loved these guys. He's like a kind of an outsider guy who wanted to be involved, and then they let him in. And so he created this thing called the English-Speaking Union, and it wouldn't be called that if not for Rhodes' English-speaking idea that he picked up from John Robert Seeley and used in his last will and testament, the English-speaking Union. And that's why Winston Churchill wrote those books on it, the English-speaking peoples. It's all based on this same idea going back to John Robert Seeley in the English Trivium, and the ideas of basic English and all of these things subsequent to that are all part of that same project, backed by the same people.
Now that we've discussed what the Trivium actually was as a tool of actually creating a homogeneous polity in order to serve the interests of gigantic empires, rather than being what it's presented to be often as now, as a sort of method for thinking critically, let's talk about actual methods for thinking critically, because that's really what this is all about. We want to be productive here. We don't just want to point to problems. Let's figure out some solutions. So, as with the conversation we just had concerning the influence and the importance of the liberal arts throughout history,
this conversation about how to think critically is going to be an ongoing one. We're definitely not going to exhaust it today, and I know this episode's already running very, very long. So I just want to spend a little bit of time discussing with Kevin here how he personally approaches research and critical thought. So I've just got a list of questions here. We might not even get to all of them, but I just want to begin the conversation on how critical thinking is done and how normal people like us can actually do like scholarly academic level research without having to go into debt and getting a history degree and all these sorts of things that essentially bar normal people, regular people, from digging into the history and philosophy, for that matter, of the past on their own. I'm not a big fan of democracy in a lot of senses, but here's something that I would like to democratize is the ability for people to actually do professional level research. Even if that's not what you're interested in, even if you don't particularly want to study history, this will at least give you the tools to examine the news when it crosses your eye or enters your head via headphones or whatever. How can we think critically? How can we analyze different statements that we hear, fact check on our own without having to rely on quote unquote professional fact checkers? We should be able to do these things on our own. So all that being said, I just want to open up the conversation and talk a little bit about how critical thinking is done. So first of all, Kevin, I've never asked you this before, and I don't know if I've ever heard you mention this, but are you a college man? Did you ever go to a fancy university?
I did not go to a fancy university. I would be probably a junior in college if I decided to go back. But I didn't find that it was an economic decision that was worth taking. If I had been going for a specialty to be a neurosurgeon or get my Juris Doctorate or some other thing, then maybe I would have gone that path or to be a professor at some university. But I didn't find that I had a specific path that I wanted to spend $80,000 or $90,000 on.
Right. Well, it's surprising to me and not surprising to me because on the one hand, you know, college to me just seems kind of like a waste, to be perfectly honest. But the way that you do research and the quality of your work that I've observed over the years, it certainly gives the impression that you've got some sort of training almost. Did you teach yourself how to do this kind of research, the like really deep historical research that you do? Because, I mean, it certainly seems like professional historian level.
Well, I really appreciate that. I've always been interested in history ever since I was a kid. I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., I'm more self-taught as far as learning how to research. I grew up in an environment that always fostered learning. My parents were very interested in politics and the ways of the world and the way things work. My dad was always very interested in computers. So at a very young age, as young as 8 years old, I was, you know, building computers and learning about what would soon become the internet with bulletin board systems. And so I was very interested in technology and then an outgrowth of that, like, you know, how that relates to the world we live in and how these advances affect culture, but also very interested in politics because I grew up in the area that I did. My grandmother was a high school teacher. My great-grandfather was a superintendent of schools, going around reading Elwood P. Cubberley's books before I even ever heard of them. John Taylor Gatto talked about in the Ultimate History Lesson. My uncle was also an educator. So I do come from a family that is involved in education. I've always been interested in history and reading. I didn't think that society worked that way. It didn't make sense to me. It seemed like a Ponzi scheme, like to take out loans in order to barely be able to get a job in that field. And that's really what I should say. My belief in higher education was kind of enunciated by participating in it. It didn't seem like the path for me. It may be for other people. There's a lot of mythology tied to it. And if you don't go to college, you're going to make $1 million less. It's like one of the first things they tell you, right? Like when you take orientation courses, they try to get you to put on these different hats and everybody has to take the same classes and shit. So I didn't find it valuable for my future. It is for a lot of people. I know people that have spent $80,000 on sociology and psychology degrees that are working at supermarkets and that are working in fields that are totally unrelated to what they were doing. And I've also worked in the private sector and gotten burnout working for different firms or in different industries
and didn't really find that was the path for me either. So I've always been interested in history and technology and free expression and poetry and music. Ever since I was a kid, I always had notebooks full of poems and, you know, philosophical thoughts on what I thought of the world from whatever little perspective that I had at the time. I also kind of got uprooted from the Washington, D.C. area at a formative time in my life, in which I was moved to the Midwest with, at that time, a lot of small-minded thinking compared to the world that I had been introduced to. This was like before really the internet had created this kind of ubiquitous culture where you could go anywhere and see the exact same stuff and people think the same way. You could actually find a lot more particularity, which wasn't always a good thing because that could lead to a lot of like bigotry and backwards thinking and stuff like that. So I've always been interested in social dynamics and how that works. And you know, when you're coming in as somebody that's an outsider, you know, your freshman year to a town you've never been in, that's like smaller than the intermediate school you went to on a good day, it's a different environment. You know, I had a strong interest in how the government worked and why, and the history of it. You know, when you live down the road from the Manassas battlefield, or when you can go to Williamsburg or Gettysburg pretty quickly, or you can go stand at the Jefferson Memorial anytime you want, or you can go look at the Constitution anytime you want, you can go to the archives anytime you want. And I spent most of my life as a, you know, a kid skateboarding. You know, that was a big thing for me. And I think that skateboarding also played a major role in my thinking, because, you know, absent any method, it's very easy to figure out. You step on a board and you move your foot a certain way, push down and slide up your foot, and then jump at the same time. And then that creates this thing called an ollie. And once you've achieved that and you try to land it, and then you can take that to other things. I credit skateboarding with helping me see the world in a different way, because when I'm driving down the road, even at the age that I'm at now, and I see a ledge on the side of the street that most people would think, oh, that's just like something to barricade flowers, you know, in front of a building, I'm actually seeing like a pretty nice place to do a nose slide or something like that. You know, like I'm looking at the world in a different way that doesn't leave you. So I think that that played a major role in, you know, thinking for myself. That's one of the things about the Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto that was very interesting to me, how he talked about how, you know, it's these individualist sports and activities that a lot of the colleges really look for in people. And he says, you know, here's what they told me. It was unicycling over broken terrain. You know, like that this guy had created all these different tricks and things for it. And that really resonated with me because I grew up skateboarding. My brother skateboarded. We got like our first board like when I was like in second grade. It opened a lot of avenues for me in my life and introduced me to a lot of really cool people. And so as I got older, I think I took some of those forms of expression, writing poetry and things, and got into audio production and making like hip hop beats and instrumental stuff like that. And, you know, started putting some of my poetry to rap, you know, to start it off just like being out in the country, discussing politics, driving around on back roads, hung a mic on the rearview mirror, hooked up to a mini disc, playing instrumentals and just like discussing the world, like having, you know, having sessions and things like that. So it's a hard question for me to answer. Each one of us have a lot of different points that make up how we got to a certain place. So it's not really easy for me to pinpoint like this is how I got into history or this is it. You know, I think that, you know, we all have a unique journey in which we come to be able to think for ourselves. And to, I think that skateboarding for me allowed me to see the world in a way that most people don't, just like anybody else who's got their own hobby. This applies the things you connect with. But for me in particular, like I said, driving down the road, most people just see ledges and curbs and parking lots and things like that. And somebody with a mind for skateboarding is actually looking for, man, that'd be a good place to do, you know, a line here where I could do a trick here and I could probably jump off that. And then I could, you know, it's just a different way of looking at the world. And so, especially with the proximity to politics that I had, it was very easy for me to feel a part of the conversation. If you live inside that Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, Maryland suburbs kind of bubble, it's insulated in a way that is kind of self-sustaining. A lot of the people that grow up there end up going into seats of power and kind of a revolving door, which can be a very bad thing. But it's
I think if I hadn't grown up in that environment where, like, anytime any relatives came to town, that we were the tour guides for every museum in town, learning was just something that was very easy to do.
Right. Well, I appreciate the connection to skateboarding, because I myself was never a skateboarder, but I can really see how that translates into the kind of research that you do when you're essentially seeing what most people just see as, like, kind of dead objects. You begin to recognize these things as resources, really. You begin to see the world in a sort of opportunistic way, where what might appear to somebody is just a sort of accidental feature of the urban setting, to you actually becomes something that not only can you use it, but you can use it to your advantage. It no longer becomes an obstacle or something not to be acknowledged. It's something that you can actually use in skateboarding. The case might be, like, just for your enjoyment, but still that's a positive. Whereas translating that to historical research, most books that you probably concern yourself with, to most people, like books about education from 1898, like, most people, like, are going to walk right past that. And, like, that's boring. That's irrelevant. That doesn't matter. It's useless. But because you've got that mind, you're able to say, okay, well, here's a book, and maybe 95% of it is going to be unusable, but that 5% in there might be exactly what I'm looking for when in terms of a project. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think that I'm happy you mentioned that, because I think that a lot of people would benefit from thinking of the world in that way, in terms of, like, tools to suit your own goals, because you can really find that sort of thing anywhere. And so when you're looking at the news, or if you're reading a book, you might see something as mundane, but if you're thinking about it a little more creatively, you might actually recognize something that applies to a larger picture. So an article that might be boring or seemingly idiotic, even if it's an article that you disagree with, well, then you're going to have to wrestle with that and see, well, why do you disagree with it? What's wrong about it? What's right? Maybe I'm the one who's in error here. What am I taking for granted? All of these things, I see how that maps to skateboarding, because you've also got that provision of, you know, if you hop on that ledge the wrong way, well, there's the provision of the ground plus gravity that's going to correct you real quick, like Gatto's Art of Driving, the bit from the book, which Brett Vanat read on in a YouTube video, is one of my favorite things I love to show to people. It's like, you know, you're going to learn real quick to be careful when you're driving, because there's no court of appeals for stupidity on the road. So yeah, I've got this list of questions, and I just want to blast through it with the time we have left. And we these are subjects that we'll come back to time and time again. I really look forward to, like, actually working with one another on research projects. And so maybe in the future we could actually do a show where we, like, live, like, real time, do research together and, like, talk back and forth just to show people this is what this looks like. Kind of give, like, a walkthrough example. So that being said, just, like, nutshell answers to really big questions. So here's a good one. The first one on my list is, how does an independent researcher get over self-doubt? What I mean by that is the self-doubt of not being a professional. Like, I'm just some schmuck. Who am I? Like, how do you get over that?
Don't go into it with that ideological investment at all. Be open to be proven wrong on what you think is the case in reality, and realize that a lot of people just hold credentials and not the actual facts necessary. I just think the sooner you get over those societal fallacies, the better for your confidence and for the competence of your research. Because if you're constantly looking over your shoulder thinking that, oh, well, this isn't up to par with, you know, academic level, well, go read other academic level stuff and then see what is it that makes that up to par. What are those standards that people look for? Maybe you're not being objective enough. You know, maybe you're being too objective. Getting over self-doubt really just comes from putting in the work and realizing that you're just as competent as anybody else, and maybe more, because you have the interest. A lot of these people are getting paid to write these papers. You're doing it because you like it.
On this issue, what I said in my very first episode was, look, I don't have any laurels to rest on, so I've got to, like, be really good about what I do. So that it adds to competence, ideally. All right, next question. How does a research project begin?
Really, for me, it begins as a coalescence of data. When I have enough data points that I feel like I can present a better picture of what I think is going on, I don't go out of my way looking for a thesis on something. I read a lot from a lot of different sources, from people on both sides of an issue, in order to see what the nuance is and to try to place it within its time. So for me, a research project begins with some kind of passionate spark that's just like, oh, wow, like that's a really important point that's never been talked about before. Why was Pestalozzi doing that thing at that particular point in time with this other guy who, you know, hurt her, or what, you know, whatever the point is. And I catalog these things in my mind and I decide in some kind of priority in which I want to pursue that project. A lot of times for me, it happens by coming across something so astonishingly against what I already thought I knew that, like, I feel like I can't go any further unless I thoroughly understand what I thought I already knew. So a lot of times a research project that I'm just doing for myself begins by, wow, that's a contradiction to what, like, everybody thinks is the case. And maybe there's something worth digging in there. Maybe there's some nuance to worth looking into. May not be the truth, but if I find that arguments haven't been contended with, that seems like something that's niche worth scratching.
Right on. Okay. The next question I would ask is, once you actually have a research project picked out and you kind of maybe see, if you don't know exactly where it's going to take you, you might at least recognize the direction it's going in. What are some of the first questions you're going to ask yourself as you enter into that project to keep yourself as objective as possible and to frame?
Who, what, when, where, why?
Yeah. What, when, where, why?
Yeah. That's really what it comes down to. You have to understand the context and the time frame in which you're researching to be able to understand the mentality, the milieu of the time. So for me, it comes by trying to discern the basic facts. Want to look at what other people have said about these things in the past. You want to find who are the respected scholars in the field. You want to find if there are people that dissent to the respected scholars in the field. So for me, it really begins with questions. Every beginning of any project is really just like, why was this happening? What was the cultural reason for it? What was going on? What are the different opposing forces? So it just starts by asking questions, I think, for me, for any project. Nowadays, you can search the context of millions of books. Whereas back in the day, if you were doing this, you're going to be in the basement of some courthouse, like looking through a library somewhere, hoping that they happen to have the book that you want, or waiting for somebody to order it in so you can read it. So we have unlimited resources in order to seek out relevant information. Try not to take any specific interest as a position until you have a context. Eventually, a lot of historical issues are going to force you to take a position. If you're looking at like atrocities of war and things like that, it's going to be very difficult to stay neutral on the competing narratives. That's just one area on how to seek out relevant information and how to check up on specific claims. Look what's out there in academia. Look what's out there in alternative history. And being able to tell good information from bad. Learn logical fallacies. Be able to identify what confirmation biases are, avoid groupthink, perhaps look into things like the Dunning-Kruger effect and realize that not everybody recognizes their own incompetence in certain areas. And it's very easy to be, by definition, a charlatan. Not saying that in like in a super negative way. It's just very easy to not realize that you are ideologically motivated and that that can steer your research and your conclusions. Because if you go into something with a preformed idea, it's very easy to, you know, kind of make everything try to fit that equation. And that's definitely something you don't want to do with history. So I like to read the books of the people that they say are they that are doing these things and stuff like that, because I want to read their perspective, not somebody else's perspective of it. And that's a problem, I think, a lot in like conspiracy culture and even in just mainstream culture and CNN and MSNBC and mainstream propaganda, Fox, whatever, is that, you know, people are relying on the furrowed brow, you know, the guy that gets the most upset about the event or whatever it is and can frame it for their ideological team. And you have to recognize that that's pretty obvious to a lot of people, but that's going on in history books, too. These very well-formed written history books that are academic, you have these same battles taking place. You have people, you know, putting out propaganda within their works or framing things a certain way because they benefit from that specific interpretation. So being able to tell good information from bad information is to identify ideologies, identify what somebody has as an underlying vision. It's very difficult for anybody nowadays to be 100% objective, unless we're talking about the ingredients to cake or something. It's very difficult because everything is ideologically motivated. Everybody's picking a team. Very important if you're going to try to be a historian to try to be objective. I'm not sure I agree with every connotation of what critical thinking is, because the very mention of it kind of supposes an objectivity to critical thinking. I think we are ideologically driven people. I think that we come prepackaged because of our families and our religions and these other things with a lot of biases that we have to sort through in order to understand what objectivity actually is and what critical thinking is. So you can levy at anybody who you disagree with. Well, you're not thinking critically. You're not using critical thinking because you don't think like me. You're not using my method to come to my conclusions. Therefore, you don't have it. Truth is a cudgel and I own it. Many people only have time nowadays with the human resource, societal and, you know, engagement that we have. Many people only have time for third party interpretations of the historical material to begin with. We, you know, whether it be the current events of the day with mainstream media or whether it be historically, it's easier to read a 2-page article that summarizes Plato than it is to read Plato for a lot of people. You don't have time for that. You're going to read all these different books and then you have to read the people they're talking about because you don't understand the context. It's difficult for people to build out. People want that crib notes history. And unfortunately, that leads to a lot of Mad Lib history. But many people only have time for third-party interpretations to the material to begin with, and that leads to adopting ideological positions without even realizing they've done so. And so if you don't have a general baseline for how to discern the set and setting and the context absent an ideology, you are unwittingly filtering and perpetuating someone else's biases, and you're repeating or pointing to analysis that you haven't researched yourself, and eventually you'll take pride in pretending that you haven't done that. You don't recognize your own investment. And so I think the best thing to do if you want to be a critical thinker is to realize that these standards of critical thinking are very much contextually bound to your culture and to your society and to your environment. If you grew up in a religious environment and you go there and you say, I don't agree with you because I'm a critical thinker, they're going to say, well, we use critical thinking. We use logic. You know, we just have a different Godhead. And because we accept a different Godhead and a certain set of facts that you don't accept, our entire conclusion is going to be different than yours. So you're going to bump up against a reality that is not as concrete as you think it is. I think just being honest with yourself and realizing that it's very easy to get misled. Nothing to be like super dejected about if it happens. There are many times I've gone down a historical path and been like, hey, you know, like maybe the framing in which I was introduced to this was entirely wrong. Like maybe I was viewing this through somebody else's lens. A practical example of this would be Carol Quigley, how the work that he put out in Tragedy and Hope on the history of the Roundtable Group gets interpreted by a whole group of people in society, John Birch Society and these others, and in one way, and by those in intellectual circles another way. One way it's conspiratorial, the other way it's the progress of history. We find our future in institutions because those are the things that are going to survive. And so it's very easy to frame that from a conspiratorial point of view and say, these guys are working nefariously behind the scenes in order to do this thing, but they publish it. Like it's out in the open. You can read all of this stuff. They're able to do those things because you're not participating in the conversation. You're just yelling at it from the outside. You're not learning the history of it and being able to rebut it and present arguments for or against whatever it is you disagree with.
I love that conclusion. That's perfect. That's kind of like the unspoken point of my whole series is like, I'm going to tell you the story of critical thinking. And in every episode, you're going to notice that they all said the people we talked about in the last episode were wrong. Yeah. So it's like, it's always also, it's like there is a through line. Like, okay, well, we are talking about people are trying to figure out how to be consistent and how to weigh and how, like, there's a general understanding, like a sort of intuitive grasping of this. I'll invoke the name of the great Plato. It's like there's an ideal.
But most people don't grasp that point, the practical ideal behind it.
No, indeed, they do not.
And that is what I've endeavored to rectify in my own little way by putting this series about critical thinking out there. As the listener may recall, I began episode 1 all that time ago by reading a definition of critical thinking which went something like, critical thinking is thinking about thinking. Ultimately, that's what I hope these tales of rationality and logical systems throughout the millennia will inspire you all to do, to just spend some time thinking about thinking. Take what you find useful and relevant from past thinkers, from the founding fathers to Da Vinci, from John of Salisbury to Aristotle, from Plato and Socrates, all the way back to Prometheus and Thoth and Oannes. Take it in, throw out the garbage, be as consistent as you can be, and get to know your own mind. I sincerely hope you've enjoyed this series as much as I've enjoyed making it, and I welcome all feedback on this at storyofnowhere.com. Just don't be too critical. I look forward to continuing the conversation on logic and critical thought now that this groundwork has been done, and I look forward to digging deeper into research methods and practices in the future as I continue to produce more shows for all you fine people. Of course, my deepest thanks and appreciation to Kevin Cole, not just for joining me for this extra-long episode, but for being such a powerful, positive influence on me and the way in which I take in information, going back years before we ever actually spoke. So thank you all. In closing, I'll leave you with the song mentioned earlier in the show, Letters to Isidore by our very own Kevin Cole. Enjoy.
Abraham, what I could not say earlier from my pulpit, as it were, is that I view your crime as a mere symptom of a more serious disease that is afflicting these colonies. Anarchy.
You mean self-rule?
I mean chaos. Masquerading as freedom. An excuse for criminal activity and every man for himself.
Well said. If these upstarts were truly concerned with your liberty, they wouldn't encourage smuggling on the one hand and then roll you with the other.
So, we all must pay a tax. The question is just who will collect.
Oh God, that one might read the Book of Fate and see the revolution of the times make mountains level and the continent, weary of solid firmness, melt itself into the sea.
Ah, your father is the only man that I can find here with affection for the humanities. Did you pass your trivium on to your son?
No man is above the law. That is what you taught me. And I will gladly accept whatever punishment you deem fit for my forgetting it.
Well, I doubt you can afford to pay the fine.
It pains me to recommend imprisonment, but we must have no favorites.
There may be a temporary salve. His Majesty has decreed that any of his errant subjects may be forgiven their transgressions if they pledge an oath.
An oath of loyalty, yes, yes. That is ideal. It's a public oath and paper. When it becomes clear that your cooperation assisted in the capture of the enemy, then any doubt will be put to rest.
What the percussion album is all about.
Here's how the message gets infected inside. Since perception cut short, they elect that it dies. Ineffective until language they claim and offer you freedom. Provisional authority complex, you don't need them. No instructions, devoid of sectarian claims. Erected edifice, and it's not that complex, it's just chains. Locked in the key has always been language. Defined legions and passive anguish. Eternal plaintiffs, overtaking your brain through glass cages. So fuck the masons for lost ages. Organic unity's just been blasted like Boston's faces. So can to take this to critical nonsense, but you'll be back to the order in Britain's table of contents. Too many roads and Hecate's a demon for asking. Liberal education exists by fragments and last bastions. So benefactions can bask in a mask of occulted wisdom and never carry a rhythm to indigenous children. See how I collapsed the arch in the whole fucking building? The magistry by so-called fallacies, dangling by the thread of Carolingian dynasties. I refuse to say pretty please. This reason is a birthright. No citizen subjectivity can take that away. If that means people have the right to be irrational, so be it. Tear down the structures. Life's too fucking short to follow orders. No soldiers quartered and backyards are placed on a border. It wasn't yours in the first place. It wasn't yours in the first place.
Did you pass your trivium onto your son?